The Senate Committee on Health Policy, this February 16th, 2005 day. And before we really get started, I wanted to let you know that we have the next couple of weeks planned out, and we've actually handed out a schedule. Today we're going to hear from, we're going to talk about the healthcare marketplace, a 101 on that, and then the role of health insurance, and then health care cost drivers. That'll be from 1 to 3 today. And then from 5 to 6, there will be food in the Galleria for the public. And we're going to have a public hearing on health care access and cost issues from 5:30 to 7:30 tonight. And that will not be here. It will be in room 50. Which is down in the basement. Then on February 21st, we'll be hearing having hearings on non-cost containment bills. We have other bills that we need to hear on that day. And then February 23rd, it'll be invited testimony only on Oregon's acute care hospital capacity utilization and financial trends, as well as behind Oregon's healthcare crisis. On February 28th, again, invited testimony only on hospital rate regulation. That's when we are going to be having John Colmers from the Milbank Memorial Foundation and Robert Murray from the Maryland Health Services Cost Review Commission. That night, we will have another evening of a planned panel discussion on healthcare facility representatives regarding rate regulation. March 2nd, we'll have the tentatively the first public hearing on Senate Bill 502. March 7th, we will have a discussion on certificate of need, and again another evening one, again a planned panel discussion regarding certificate of need. And then March 9th, tentative first public hearing on Senate Bill 503, the certificate of need. So that sort of gives you an idea of where we're going. We probably will be putting in maybe one or two little bills in between, but that's where we're going. And with that, I would like to have Dr. Bruce Goldberg and Bob DePreet start this wonderful session out.
Good afternoon. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, Administrator of the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research.
For the record, Bob DePreet, also Office of Policy and Research.
We have a two-hour extravaganza planned for you today, really as a sort of high-level overview of the healthcare system. Bob and I are going to start out and provide you with an overview of the healthcare system, some information about expenditures and how care is organized. Then Barney Spade will talk about cost drivers from 2 to 2:30, and then Joel Ario and Rocky King are going to talk about the private healthcare marketplace. Bob and I hope that our part of this will be informal, and please feel free to interrupt for questions. And let me turn it over to Bob to start out.
Very well. I just wanted to start by saying what is probably obvious to all of you anyway, which is that what we call the healthcare system in Oregon and in the United States isn't really an efficient or effective system at all. It wasn't designed. It came into being without an overall plan, one piece at a time, and things have been added or modified as exigencies required. Healthcare finance and delivery are both fragmented. Funding comes from many different sources. Delivery of services takes place in many different settings depending on the population where people can get access to care. Information systems are inadequate for management needs. It's very difficult to find out what we'd like to know about the care that's being delivered and how much it costs. Responsibilities are often unclear, which makes it possible for people to feel as though they're falling through cracks in the system and are not getting the care that they ought to be getting. Programs overlap and leave gaps. Some people are doubly insured. Some people are not covered at all. Funding is piecemeal, haphazard. It comes from many sources, including federal, state, county, employers, charity care, and the patients themselves. The tax codes, state and federal, contribute to fragmentation because they include subsidies for health care that were developed, again, one piece at a time. And these subsidies are complex. Many of them are hidden. Many of them are even unintentional. And this contributes to instability and inequity in the way that health care is financed and delivered. As a result, providers tend to feel underpaid, purchasers feel overcharged, patients often feel overlooked, and everybody involved, all parties, feel at risk, either for foregoing care that they need or for the cost of health care that they do get or that they provide. Delivery systems are convoluted, and they have to fight to preserve some level of financial solvency. Often this is done in response to the funding that is available so that the form of the delivery system follows the funding that's available. If there's money for something, it's going to be provided. If there's not, it's going to be much more difficult to get the service. Resources and programs are fragmented and overlap. As I said, the financing is extremely complex. Coverage is disparate depending on whether you're on Medicaid, Medicare, private insurance, which is group and individual, Veterans Administration, Indian Health Services, and an array of other programs that provide care. Now, despite the fact that this is not really a system that was designed to work efficiently and effectively, the parts are connected, and what happens in one part of the healthcare finance and delivery framework affects things in other sections. As an example, uninsurance leads to cost shift. The uninsured often can't pay for care, but illness is inevitable, and the cost of the care that they do receive is passed along to paying customers. So nothing is really free in the system. Someone is uninsured or otherwise unable to pay, and they get health care, and it's not paid for directly. It ends up being paid for indirectly through cost shift of one form or another. Inadequate payments in one part of the system lead to increased costs elsewhere in the system, meaning higher costs for some purchases of care. In many cases, there'll be an entire program which is at least perceived to be underpaying for services, and as a result, charges go up, and payments in other sectors of the healthcare system also go up. Inadequate access to effective primary care leads to avoidable specialty care, avoidable emergency care, and avoidable hospital admissions. All too often, someone unable to get effective basic primary health care ends up with a condition that requires much more expensive treatment, which they may not be able to pay for, at least in full. And inefficiencies waste resources throughout the system and reduce the quality of care and reduce health outcomes across the board. The money that we do spend on health care in the United States is not always spent effectively and efficiently, in part because we don't have a well-oiled, well-designed system to provide and finance care.
With that, I have a chart that shows you the history of the careers of many of us in the room, as well as, I think, documentation of the fact that history does tend to repeat itself. And what this is a chart of healthcare expenditures over the last 50 years, since 1960 or so, and what's happened, the continual sort of ebb and flow of healthcare costs. If you turn to the next page, it really shows you the...
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Dr. Goldberg, early 60s, what caused that sharp dip?
In the early 60s was the sharp dip was the beginnings of Medicare and Medicaid as national health care programs that brought in some price controls and diminished some of the cost shift that was occurring in the system.
So to a degree, a lot of the dips across time have been attempts to manage the market. Would that be a fair statement?
Very much so.
Okay.
That's exactly what you're seeing. And in fact, if you go to the next slide, what you'll see is that during the late 80s and early 90s, we were again in a time when we had double-digit healthcare inflation. And our attempt to manage costs at that point was managed care. and we saw managed care through the mid-90s actually bring prices back into control. And we saw healthcare costs decrease, and then as there was a backlash against managed care, as consumers didn't want to be told what they could or could not consume, as providers didn't want to be told what they could and couldn't provide, we've seen a return towards open and free choice and a rise in healthcare costs. I think the more interesting piece of this is not as much the rise and fall of healthcare costs, it's the real stability in overall inflation and in workers' wages, which you see there as well. And you have to consider that when healthcare costs rise out of pace with workers' wages and with general inflation, that tends to create an even greater problem in terms of purchasing power.
Now, just to clarify, with the Oregon Health Plan, we don't have premiums as such. You can't but it is primarily managed care. Is that correct?
Chair Mona Sanderson, that's correct. The increase in premiums, this really is a marker for health care costs in general.
Okay.
These are family health care premiums over the last decade, really as a marker for overall health care costs. Right now, we think of premiums as one piece of it. There are co-pays and other costs and expenses that people pay out of pocket. This is really just meant as a marker of the rise and fall of overall health care costs.
Thank you.
And we'll get into some of that in a moment. The next slide is a bit of a parlor game, but it just really shows you what indeed would happen if we continue to see double-digit increases in health insurance premiums. At the same time, we see a 2 and 3% increase in workers' wages. Somewhere at about the year 2016, we will see the average healthcare premium, insurance premium, be greater than the average salary that a worker in this country earns. So indeed, this is a problem, and indeed, rising healthcare costs are driving a lot of what we're seeing in the healthcare market today, and we'll get at that in a moment. National healthcare spending.
Senator Marisette.
Okay. I'm sorry. Thank you. That's also in relation to the economy, of course. And I would think when the economy is good and insurance companies put their money into the market and start to then get back to where they would want to be, that some rates may come down. I think the market crash really upset health costs, particularly in insurance premiums, I think. So this is an economic cycle that we're dealing with, right?
Chair Mona Sanderson and Senator Morissette, in some ways, however, what drives the health care costs is not so much the investments and the insurance and underwriting cycle of what might be seen as casualty or other types of insurance, but a lot of this is due to the underlying factors of what's adding to health care costs. And you'll have a whole section on that in a bit, but it's about technology and aging and a variety of the other factors that are contributing to the rise.
Okay. Just a clarification, please. I wasn't, I guess I, my question was broader than that, because I think that the economy, the general economy, makes a lot of difference. If people are working and earning a decent wage, then they can afford to pay their health care costs much better than if there isn't. You know, if the market crashes and there are a lot of layoffs and there are not out of jobs, we are climbing out of that recession, and hopefully that will make a difference in affordability.
Absolutely. We'll get at that in a minute, but I think what you're getting at is the counter-cyclical nature of some of this. When the economy is good and employment is low and businesses compete for workers and wages are high, that there is a lot of move towards employer-based health care coverage when the economy is bad and when we see rises in unemployment and health care costs increasing, more uninsured, less ability for businesses to cover those costs, less ability for states to pick those up as well. So it's a counter-cyclical cycle, and that's actually what we saw in the mid-90s when we saw a dramatic decrease in uninsurance in the state. A lot of that was due to we had much higher employment. We had a booming economy. We had tremendous competition for workers. We had much more employer-based health insurance, the ability of the state to cover more people, and those factors actually combined proportionately, that the ability of the state to cover low-income folks as well as the ability of the private sector to cover workers proportionally lowered uninsurance. And once again, we've been in a position where we're seeing rises in that as funds for both state and industry become tight. Nationally, healthcare expenditures have been growing at double digits for the last several years. Between 1990 and 2002, healthcare spending grew to a point where we were about 12% of the gross domestic product to where we're now about 15% of the gross domestic product. Interestingly enough, in the early 60s, healthcare expenditures were about 6% of the gross domestic product. So we've seen healthcare expenditures almost triple as their percentage of the gross domestic product over the last 50 years. When the gross domestic product grows slowly and healthcare spending grows quickly, that factor is amplified, and we touched on that a moment ago. You can see, actually, this really better mimics the rise in personal healthcare expenditures, not healthcare premiums, but the next slide shows the increase in healthcare expenditures since 1991, Oregon compared to the U.S., and what we've seen here in this state is that in 1991, the average personal healthcare expenditure per capita was approximately $2,300, and in 1998, it had increased close to 50% to $3,300. And there's nothing that tells us that the slope of that line has actually changed any over the last 5 years. That's just the last data point that we have good national and state comparisons for. As you've seen, you know, compared with the nation, Oregon's healthcare expenditures are lower. Our average healthcare expenditures were $334 in 1998, you know, compared to, actually the number on the graph is the corrected figure, $3,759 for the nation, but that the slope of the line has remained following the national increases. Annual per capita expenditures for Medicaid in Oregon in 1998 were $3,167 compared with $3,882 for the nation. And in Medicare, we see the same thing, expenditures being $4,300 compared to about $5,500.
Rick?
Thank you, Senator. Bruce, I know there's some inequity in what Medicare pays by regions of the country. Is that reflected in some of these other charts as well, that some of the lower Medicare that is reimbursed in Oregon gives us a lower cost for spending?
Medicare reimbursement is lower in the state for two reasons. One reason is that payment rates are set geographically, and Oregon has a lower geographic payment rate than some other parts of the country, such as Florida and New York. But the other piece is exactly why our line is lower than the nation's, is that we use less health care. We're more efficient. We were a state that moved to managed care a lot quicker than other states did. We have a much more efficient healthcare marketplace. We also have different cultural trends and utilization. We have more people who, for instance, die at home than in the hospital in this state. And we know that a lot of healthcare expenditures occur in the last years of someone's life, and particularly particularly in the last few months of someone's life, we have a tendency in this state to utilize less health care at the end of life. As a result, our Medicare expenditures are less as well. While we're less compared, we still are continuing, however, to increase at the same rate as everybody else's. The next piece, really, I believe, gets at Chair Monis Anderson, what you are getting at, asking about premiums. There's overall health care premium, and then there's the percentage of premium that people pay out of pocket. And then if you look at the next two slides, it really shows that as health care expenditures have gone up, the marketplace has reacted in a couple of ways. And one of those ways has been to shift some of those costs onto consumers. And so whereas in 1988, nationally, an individual would pay an $8 a month premium for their employer-based health insurance and $50 a month to cover their family if they were employed and had their health insurance through a business. By the year 2003, that had increased to $200 a month for family coverage and $42 a month for individual coverage. $200 a month for low-income families has made family health insurance coverage for low-income workers very unaffordable. And the next slide actually shows you what's happened in Oregon, and this is actually Oregon compared to national statistics. And actually, it's not Oregon compared to national, it's just the Oregon statistics. And you can see that in Oregon, we've seen the same thing. Since the late 90s, we've seen rises in both single and family employee contributions toward healthcare premium that have increased steadily. Not only have employee premium contributions increased, but other costs have increased as well. Copays for medicines, for office visits have also increased. So the next question is, where does all this money go? And as we see the slope of that line increase, where do the expenditures go? And the next page gives you a sense of where the healthcare dollar goes. We see that the largest chunk of healthcare dollar goes to hospital care, followed with physician and other professional services, drugs and other non-durable meds, nursing facilities, and home health care. This is overall healthcare expenditures, and it varies differently in different segments of the market. And you'll see that for the Medicare program, for instance, the expenditures on prescription drugs are higher. But this gives you a sense of where the dollars go. In Medicaid in 2003, what you can see is that for the U.S., about 58% of the dollars went to acute care as opposed to 61% in Oregon, and that 37% went to long-term care. We spend increasingly greater percentage of our Medicaid dollar on long-term care. That's because as our population ages, we have a Medicare program which provides health benefits to elderly people over 65, but does not cover long-term care, which is one of the services that is most needed by people as they grow older. We have a Medicaid program which covers care for those who are low-income. It covers long-term care for low-income elderly populations as well as for disabled that the Medicare program doesn't cover. So when Bob was talking about a non-system of health care, it's an odd health care system where we have a Medicare program for seniors that, well, up until 2006 will not have covered drugs and does not cover long-term care, two of the pieces of healthcare that are most important to seniors, and we have a Medicaid program that picks up the expenditures for those. The next slide gives you a sense of where dollars go in the Oregon Health Plan, and what you can see is that 26% of the expenditures go to prescription drugs, 27% goes to hospital care, 20% to physicians, and you can see the rest of the breakout. But it gives you a sense of when we pay for health care, where those dollars go. When we think about health care...
Oh, yes. Could you just explain the PMPM?
Oh, sure. Chairman Sanderson, PMPM is per member per month expenditures. So it's a way of looking at the dollars per Medicaid recipient per month. And it's just a way of equilibrating the expenditures across the population. So $20.57 per member per month for dental care, $65.95 per Medicaid recipient per month for hospital care, $61.42 for prescription drugs. Basically taking all the dollars in those categories that are spent across the year and dividing them by the number of people per month.
Yes. Thank you. Bruce, is information available to show a trend over the last few years on this pie chart? Has that increased? Has it been pretty steady in terms of percentages?
We're working on actually getting that to you, and I think there have been different changes in different segments of the market, some which have grown faster than others.
Thank you. Good question.
Okay. This is all really in the context of health insurance, and just wanted to spend a moment talking about health insurance and why we have health insurance, and really for three reasons, and each of us makes these decisions differently. One is asset protection, to protect ourselves from catastrophic loss and to provide catastrophic coverage. This tends to be more important to those who have actually some assets to protect and who access to care is less important. For people like myself, I'm actually concerned in protecting my assets. If my child gets sick, I will get them to the doctor, and I'm fortunate enough to be able to pay for that expense out of my pocket. It's less important to those without means and who have to worry about affording access to care. For low-income, working poor individuals, the issue isn't about protecting their assets from a catastrophic health care event. The issue is getting access to basic health care and being able to afford that. So health insurance for different populations really provides different means of access. Health insurance can promote access to care by making outpatient care more affordable and more accessible for people. And we also use health insurance to manage risk and to spread that risk across the population to assure some degree of predictability and equity. And the basis of health care insurance is to share risk across a population so that when my risk for 1 year is large, I can share that with the risk of many others who may not have that. In terms of health care coverage in the state, the private market covers approximately 56% of the health care marketplace in the state. Approximately 2 million individuals receive health care coverage through what would be called the private marketplace. This is commercial insurance. These are businesses that self-insure. These are individuals who individually insure themselves. The Oregon Health Plan accounts for about 13% of coverage in the state. Medicare, 14%. And the uninsured are now up to about 17%, or 609,000 people. This is a significant variation from during 1990 to 2004, where we've seen changes, and I'll show those to you in a moment. Nationally, what you can see is that we actually are fairly comparable to the national healthcare statistics. 59% of national healthcare is in the private marketplace, so we're a bit lower. perhaps due to the fact that we're a small business state, not a large business state. In terms of Medicaid, we're really right at about the national average in terms of the percentage of the state's population that's covered. We are a bit higher in Medicare, and that's consistent with our state's demographic. We have an older population than many other states. And in uninsured, we are now, unfortunately, we've become like Lake Wobegon. We are now above average, and we have become above the national average, whereas once we were below the national average and had lower numbers of uninsured, we are now above the national average, which is approximately 16%. The next page gives you a sense of that trend. In the early 90s, we had uninsurance as high as about 18%. That dipped to a low of 10% in the mid-90s. Once again, as we talked about previously, a combination of a couple of factors. A booming economy, as well as expanded coverage in the state in terms of the Oregon Health Plan. When you look at the breakdown by age, actually, it becomes a bit more startling. Medicare covers most people over 65, so the bottom line there are the numbers of individuals without health insurance who are over 65. You can see children's coverage as the middle line, and one of the things to point out here is that we've actually seen a progressive rise in the number of uninsured children in the state, even during a time when we've added coverage in the Oregon Health Plan. We have not cut children from the health plan over the last 5 years. In fact, we've expanded coverage. And then you can see that in adults 18 to 64, we have uninsurance rates that are approaching a quarter of the population, 22%. The next slide just really gives you a sense, once again, of what happens when we see rising healthcare costs. What we see is, as healthcare costs go up, we see a couple of things. We see an inability of the state to cover most vulnerable citizens. And once again, you can see that in the next slide with the drop in Oregon Health Plan standard population and our drop from covering over 100,000 individuals to now we're probably a bit below 40,000 individuals. We see an inability of individuals to afford individual coverage, and we see businesses that can no longer afford to cover their workers. We actually know that approximately the same number of businesses offer health insurance in the state today as did 5 or 6 years ago. The issue is that now, as you saw previously, the workers' share of premium has increased and made health care unaffordable, particularly family coverage, for many workers. And there are consequences to that dramatic increase in uninsurance, and the consequences are that people who don't have health insurance have reduced access to care, they receive too little medical care, and they receive it too late. They have poor medical outcomes. The uninsured are, by every study and every documentation, they're a group that are sicker and they die sooner than the rest of the population. And the medical care that they receive is more expensive because they tend to put off receiving health care until illnesses are more advanced, and as a result, care is more expensive. And we all are paying the cost of that. The uninsured have higher mortality. They're 1.25 times more likely to die than those who are insured. If you're uninsured and you go into the hospital, you're more likely to die in the hospital if you're uninsured than if you're insured, primarily because of the fact that you present at a later stage of illness, and that you're up to 4 times as likely to require hospitalization and emergency care for chronic illness if you're uninsured. If you have diabetes, asthma, you're more likely to be hospitalized and to seek care in an emergency room if you're uninsured than if you're insured. And then lastly, inadequate health insurance can not only hurt you physically, but it can hurt you financially as well. A recent study showed that the number one cause of personal bankruptcy in this country is lack of health insurance.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Is the spend down for eligibility of seniors factored in or out of that?
In or out of the bankruptcy?
Yeah.
I don't know, but I can find out.
Okay, thank you. I mean, that's a systemic thing that happens, okay.
I believe, I mean, the study alludes to that, in that when this was some work that looked at people who had gone into become bankrupt because of medical debt, what they found out was that actually 75% of those individuals were actually insured at the beginning of their illness. And then as they became more in debt, were increasingly ill, they lost health insurance coverage, became uninsured, had actually increased medical debt, and then went into bankruptcy. So people are spending down, their illnesses are costing them more, and that's the cycle that happens.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I understand that, and that does happen. I just want to make sure that we're, because there's, I mean, folks that do that intentionally, and I just want to make sure that, you know, I mean, some of that is the fault of the system, some of it is the fault of healthcare, and I just want to make sure we've kind of got a separation there.
Senator Cruz, point well taken.
Okay.
Certainly there are a lot of issues for bankruptcy. I think in terms of this was more to make the point that these expenses are borne by us all, regardless, and that when individuals become bankrupt, no matter how that happens, whether by personal choice or through medical debt, there are consequences to them, but there are actually economic consequences to the community as well. It's usually community creditors who actually bear the brunt of that bankruptcy in terms of personal bankruptcy. So some other underlying issues and factors in terms of cost increases and inflation in the medical consumer price index was about 5% through the first 4 or 5 years of this decade. And the other piece that's accounted for the increase in healthcare costs is a piece of it is the medical care price increase, and then utilization increases, the volume and intensity of services, the new technologies, and Barney Spate will actually give you a great presentation on that in a few moments, really account for the additional increases. You know, this has resulted in the double-digit increases in premiums charged for private insurance, and I think as you know, it's also resulted in the increased costs that we've seen in state expenditures in the Oregon Health Plan, as well as in the increases in the Medicare budget that we're seeing nationally. And that when premiums rise faster than wages, there is a relative price increase that can cause additional workers to drop insurance as it becomes unaffordable. You know, compounding some of this is issues around quality within our healthcare system. Americans receive the recommended care about 55% of the time. About a third of healthcare expenditures go to care that is duplicative, fails to improve health, or sometimes even makes it worse. That we don't have the most efficient market. We have a lack of an ability to really understand as consumers of healthcare what the quality is, what the benefits of the services we're getting are, and what the costs are. 90% of healthcare information actually moves by fax, phone, or mail.
Dr. Goldberg, when you say, do you have, where did you get that statistic? Almost a third of healthcare expenditures goes to care that is duplicative.
The Institute of Medicine did a really remarkable study about 3 years ago now called Crossing the Quality Chasm, and the Institute of Medicine is probably the most scholarly and knowledgeable group around medical care in the country, and they set out and had a task force that looked at the quality of care in the country and issued a report called the Quality Chasm. And I'm actually be happy to get you the executive summary and the report of. And this really comes directly from their findings.
It'd be interesting to see what services are being provided unnecessarily. And would that report show that?
It will give you some examples of that, yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. While we're on it, would... Dr. Bates has told me more than once about the percentage of his patients that present for self-correcting conditions. That is not covered in this, is it? And, or is that part of the duplicative or not?
Senator Cruz, part of that is part of the care that fails to improve patient health. For instance, we know that there are people that go and seek care for problems that would get better on their own,
right,
and are given interventions to treat those. And as a result, there's care that's given that's not going to improve anybody's health. It's going to get better on its own, so that's part of that as well.
That's part of this. Okay, thank you.
And, Madam Chair.
Yes,
and I think you can see that on the nightly news in between the news or the commercials that tell people what to take.
Well, it's due to the commercials. It's due to the fact that there's, I mean, one of the issues that we need to grapple with as a nation is that there's a really great diversity in how things are treated from one community to another, and that the way prostate cancer is treated in one community may differ quite dramatically from how it's treated in another, or back pain or many other illnesses, and that when we look at that, what we see is that there may be great variations in the treatment as well as in the expenditures. There often is not a tremendous variation in the outcome. So that there are many studies that have looked at the variation in treatments across the country and in different cities, and have often found that the outcomes have actually been somewhat similar. That although the intensity of care given to someone to treat prostate cancer may be 10 times as great in one city versus another, that the outcome is actually the same in terms of the morbidity and mortality, how long people live, etc. And so we need to develop some discipline so that we begin to cover the care that is the most effective care, that provides the best benefit, and that provides all of us the greatest value. That's really what all of us are seeking. The state as a healthcare purchaser, all of us as individuals, we want the best care. We want what works the best, but we also want the care that's going to bring us the greatest value. We don't want to pay 10 times more for care that doesn't bring 10 times greater benefit. As I indicated, part of the problem is we don't do a very good job of measuring a lot of this. 90% of information travels by paper. We need to bring a greater degree of electronic record keeping and data keeping to our industry, and that we have a number of preventable deaths that are due to medical errors as well. An estimate of between 44,000 to 98,000 Americans die from what could be preventable mistakes. We have disparities in healthcare, not just in terms of what I mentioned in terms of the geographic disparities and how things are treated. We have racial and ethnic disparities that are consistently found across a wide range of diseases and clinical services. And these are actually found even when clinical factors such as disease stage, age, and severity of disease are taken into account. And that these disparities in care are associated with a higher mortality amongst minority populations. And indeed, this is another tragedy of our healthcare system. I alluded to this earlier, the next slide, and Barney Spate will talk about this as well. But one of the other issues that's most important is an aging population. And this next slide gives you a sense of the demographic changes that will occur in Oregon between 2003 and 2010. We will see a 53% increase in individuals between 60 and 64 years of age, 39% increase in individuals between 65 and 69 years of age, 30% increase in individuals over 85. And that adds to this picture both in terms of healthcare costs, as Barney will explain to you, but also, as you saw, in terms of long-term care. As we have an aging population, there's a greater need for long-term care. Other important issues touched on the availability of information on cost and quality. We don't know what oftentimes, whether we're a business as a purchaser, a consumer as a purchaser, as a state as a purchaser of healthcare, we don't know what we're buying. We don't know what the cost is, and we don't know the quality of the care. We need to clearly move towards more evidence-based care, being able to pay for care that has proven efficacy and not pay for care that has no benefit. What will help us do some of that is information technology and movements in that regard. Will also help with medical errors. Looming ahead are our workforce issues.
Senator Morissette.
I can't help but ask this question. Going back to the chart of between 65 and 69, it's 39%. And then the next three age categories are all, or the next, well, I'm sorry. Two of them, 75 to 79, 80 to 84, are minuses. And then 70 to 85 is another huge jump. What happened in those intervening years?
I think what you're seeing is a couple of factors. One is the you're seeing in the 60, you know, the 55 to 70 year old age group, you're beginning to see the movement, the bulge of baby boomers as we all move into that group. It is the big factor that you're seeing. I don't know what accounts for the dramatic longevity of 85-year-olds, and we'll need to have a geriatrician come in and talk to us about that. But I know the statistic is that if you do reach 85, you have a much better chance of reaching 90 than if you're 70. But I think some of that is due to the fact
well,
that...
Well, let's put it this way. If you reach 85, you have a better chance than if you don't reach 85. Right.
I will not argue with you. Those statistics come from the Oregon Population Center, and I think their best guess at our population demographics. I'm not a demographer. There are issues around workforce shortages, and certainly you can't talk about healthcare as a compartmentalized subject, and we need to take a holistic view of healthcare. And too often, when we think about healthcare, we think about physical health and doctors and hospitals, and we have different and separate conversations about mental health and about dental care. I'm a family physician. I understand that this is all connected and that we can't disconnect some of this. And I think we need to begin to develop health policies that begin to connect some of this, and that we look at these as the broader systemic issues and we look at some of these things holistically. Implications and prospects, just to sum up the implications of all of this, I think we've covered most of this. Employers, especially smaller employers, what we've seen is a decreasing employer contribution for premium and an increasing individual premium. Increased employee cost sharing, both premiums and co-pays at time of service. There have been pressures to reduce benefits, to limit benefits. That comes down to then decisions to not to be either begin offering health insurance or to stop offering health insurance. I think what we've seen more in this state is we've seen the number of businesses, and Joel Ario and Rocky King can speak to this. We haven't seen a lot of people exit providing health insurance, but we certainly haven't seen a lot of employers jump into providing coverage who haven't previously done that. On the employee side, what we do see are employees who are now turning down health insurance offered by their employers as employee premium becomes unaffordable. As you've seen, $200 a month premium for family coverage is over $2,000 a year, and for a $15,000, $17,000 a year, $20,000 a year worker, that becomes unaffordable. And that's without even copayments and co-insurances. As a result, people drop health insurance, and we see more people looking to our high-risk pool as individuals who have high-risk conditions lose health insurance through employers. They look to the high-risk pool. The stakeholder responses, states as well as actually federally, the states, what we've seen here are exactly what's happened in this state over the last several years. We've seen a reduction in benefits. We've seen in our Medicaid program, we've seen increasing Medicaid cost sharing in terms of premiums and copays. We've seen limits in Medicaid eligibility and reduced payments to providers. And all of that has contributed to much of the predicament we're in now. We're seeing the same thing on the federal level. I mean, what the federal government is seeking to do, and we're seeing this in the president's budget proposals now, is to look at how we can, on the federal level, limit Medicaid growth and federal exposure to cost increases by looking at either block-granting states or just looking at capping the federal responsibility for Medicaid exposure. There'll be perhaps an increase in Medicaid or HIPAA waivers to allow some more flexibility on ineligibility and benefits. I think there'll be some invitations for block grant, but probably more what we'll see is some sort of an annual budget from the federal government, where the federal government will do what many of the rest of us are trying to do, which is limit its exposure to rising health care costs.
Sure.
Senator Cruz.
You aren't getting in. I mean, we looked at the block grant 2 years ago and decided it was an incredibly foolish thing to do. You aren't seeing any movement by the feds to move everybody to that, are you?
We're seeing we're looking at the president's budget, and although not explicitly a block grant in terms of the financial arrangements of block grant spending, it is in essence an attempt to cap Medicaid growth at about 7.3%. So same outcome, different mechanism.
At the same time, the president's budget is putting more money into the safety net clinics. Is there a correlation there to pick up the slack, so to speak, and for the people who don't have anything?
Yes, the president's budget has proposed increasing expenditures to safety net clinics, and that's an attempt to pick up some of that slack. Of course, that does one piece of it, that provides some degree of outpatient care and outpatient access. With that, it's probably as good a place as any to pause, and we're right on time.
Wonderful.
The concept of a block grant, I mean the numbers just didn't work 2 years ago, but the idea of flexibility is wonderful. I'd be interested to see how Senator Smith is going to be looking at all this stuff, so it's going to be interesting, and I think it's important that we weigh in on the deliberations of that joint task force. So
Indeed, it's a joint state and federal partnership, and clearly what happens at the federal level is going to affect us at the state, and it's important we make our voices heard.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, Senator Smith did say he wanted state input on this, which would be a rarity for the federal government, but But it would be nice if they were looking at impacts of what they do prior to doing it, which would also be a rarity for the federal government. So,
Madam Chair,
yes, yeah, Senator Morstead.
I'm afraid the flexibility will be between having money or not having money for the programs. That's going to be the flexibility, and I'm afraid we're not going to have it.
Doesn't sound like a lot of flexibility.
Thank you,
like
Dr. Goldberg and Mr. DePriet.
I think
our pleasure.
Okay, let's have Joel Ario and Rocky King get up here. No?
Barney Spate was going to be
next. Oh, Barney's going to be next? Okay. Barney, get up here.
Yeah, he was here yesterday, but he didn't get a chance to do anything. Yeah,
Madam Chair, there was a guy who looked a lot like him a couple years ago, worked for Kaiser.
Ah, gotcha. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Barney Spate. I'm the administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, but I believe the reason I'm here today is a couple. One is I'm viewed by some as a migrant amateur health policy wonk, but I am aging. But I was the previous administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research, and so Dr. Goldberg and I have increasingly done tag team orientation. So I'm not speaking here specifically from the perspective of our Oregon's Medicaid demonstration waiver regarding cost drivers, but I will try to weave in some of the points where I think that from a state purchasing point of view that there's some implications. And I believe you all have a handout.
No.
Did everybody get something
no.
like this?
We don't have that, right?
No.
This isn't. You don't want to make a chair.
The audience is being very kind.
The audience has it, but we
yeah. uh-huh. We had a miscommunication.
That's not the way that's supposed to be.
Give them back.
Cheers.
This is another example of 90% of the information moving by paper. I apologize for that. But I won't take too much of the time, but what Dr. Goldberg asked me to do and what your committee administrator was to, and this is a variation of a presentation I made in a previous life not too many months ago to the Oregon Health Policy Commission to try to you've heard a broad overview and from Bruce and Bob, and to just try to isolate some of the large national forces, the large forces that are at work in the environment that are lying behind some of these cost increases. And I'm just going to run through about eight of them, and then or nine of them, and then quick responses about what's happening in the market, and that will be a segue to Rocky and to Joel regarding the commercial marketplace. The first cost driver I've identified in the handout is the aging population, and you heard that from Bruce earlier. I'm not a demographer either. The one anecdote I learned from a demographer, though, is that in a democracy, demographics is destiny. And I was born in 1964, so I am in the first year of the baby boom. My goal is to get as much out of
64.
Excuse me, I did a reverse. 1946. 1964 is actually the last year.
That's high school graduation.
Yeah, that's when I graduated. those that were born in 1945-46 are considered to be in the first year of the baby boom. And a lot of people look at the aging population from the point of view, what does it mean to Medicare policy? I just point out that it's not a Medicare issue. It's really an aging workforce issue. And if Oregon is really older than the national average. I'd flip over to the next page just to point out, we'll spend a minute here looking at the relationship between age and annual health costs. And you've probably seen something like this before, because one of the truisms of health care is those in Medicare consume about three times as much health care as those that are younger because they're older. If you look at that group, though, from about 50 to 64, you can see that the beginning of the upward spike of annual health care cost increases, those are people my age, You all are younger than me, so you have to confront this. But this is where I was talking to an orthopedist a few years ago that, you know, there's a lot of folks now that with the wonders of orthopedic surgery in their late 40s and 50s, lots of replaced knees, et cetera. But the body begins to wear out. And we have and it actually begins to wear out before we get to Medicare. And so I think what it's experienced by many employer coverages is they begin to see the average age of the workforce age, and there is a correlation between that aging and healthcare consumption and the underlying premiums. The point I would make, and there is a relationship here to the Medicaid program, because I think it's another widely known fact that compared to 30 or 40 years ago, the elderly generally, those 65 and older, are in much better economic situations as a class of citizens than they were in the decades before. But as a percent, the number of elderly in poverty, as that demographic bubble moves through the if we take the at percent that we serve now in the Medicaid program who are poor, vulnerable elderly, that is, and they qualify for a home and community-based waiver and the Oregon Health Plan, the sheer numbers of those people are going to increase even if the percentages stay the same, just because it's a larger group of people. So the long-term implications relative to the number of people within the state's Medicaid demonstration waiver in the area, and you can get more information from seniors and persons with disability, is a long-term trend that we're going to have to confront, not only on the long-term care and nursing home side, but on the healthcare side also. Again, democracy, demographics is destiny. The second one, medical technology, is probably, others are smarter than I am, but in my reading of healthcare literature, is many times they'll say this is the most fundamental driver of healthcare costs in this country. First of all, as a society, we're really hipped on technology, whether it be electronic games or whatever, and we've done remarkable things in the last 25 to 30 years with technology. It's not just pharmaceuticals, but because we hear a lot about the pharmaceuticals, the RX, but there's a lot being done in diagnostic imaging, in the treatment of acute diseases, non-invasive surgical procedures, etc. Technology is a wonderful kind of two-edged sword. In many ways, it's allowing curing or return to work or return home faster. I hear these remarkable stories from physicians that a procedure that 10 years ago might have a five-day length of stay, the person is now home in two or three days, back to work within a month. Major surgical procedures. And in that sense, I think technology has a real upside. The issues we have with technology, though, and I go to the third note, is what's called the flat of the curve. Many of these technologies, the benefit that's added, it's unknown whether it's really equals or is more than the cost of the new input. And that leads to really the second to the last, the lag time. One of the problems that we have in American healthcare is understanding how to use new technology, and it usually takes us, my rule of thumb, somewhere between 5 to 7 years to really understand how to use it appropriately to optimize its cost-benefit ratio. Because in many cases, where new technologies are introduced, they're diffused rather quickly. They're used too broadly on populations. Costs are borne then, and then after several years, we'll get the evidence-based medicine and say, great technology, but it has a very narrow target at this kind of population. And I mentioned the cultural fixation on technology.
Yeah.
Thank you. Barney, I heard somebody once give a presentation that there's more MRI machines in Minnesota than all of Canada. And the point being that, given that many, that there tend to be a lot of use, perhaps, even when you didn't need to use them and to pay for the machines. Is that part of the driver, too, that a lot of places have machinery and technology and use a lot?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Mr. Bacobian, I think that, you know, I can't document that, but I, you know, there is, if there is a supply, there's oftentimes particularly when we get into insurance coverage and consumer demand, there's a demand, if you will, to use it. The counter to the argument of, you know, Canada has fewer MRIs than whether it's, I've heard it, Minnesota, the state of Washington, whatever. Let's just say they don't have as much high-tech kind of stuff. And is that many people will say, and they have to stand in long queues to be able to get diagnostic things done. I've always thought someplace in the middle we ought to be able to figure out what's the right balance. The other part, and let me use this as an opportunity on technology, is one of the issues about this whole learning issue is that there have been around for decades now CT scanners and then followed by MRI scanners and now PET scanners. And one of the things that I've learned is that it's taken the profession, not only primary care docs, but radiologists working with primary care docs, to say, where is it most appropriate medically to use a CT as opposed to an MRI, because the CT scan is cheaper, but it will give you as much diagnostic information as you need for the condition that the doctor is thinking about. Same way with the MRI versus the PET. So part of this, again, is learning what are the standards of care, what's the evidence base say about how to use these kind of technologies, and in systems of managed care, whether they be in a prepaid group practice like Kaiser Permanente or even in an IPA model, those standards are inculcated within the medical community much more quickly, where it's really jointly worked upon by the specialists who understand the technology and also the primary care doctors, who are oftentimes the first line as far as ordering. Well, we'll get you an MRI. Well, oftentimes in organized systems of care, the radiologist says, what you really want for this diagnosis is a CT. So it's really learning that use of how to diffuse and appropriately use the tools that we have at hand. The cost driver three, which I mentioned to some people that I've been around almost three decades here, I've watched the change in market power over most of a professional lifetime, but we have seen a change in market power in the last 5 to 7 years. In the heyday of managed care in the middle 90s, both in this nation but also in Oregon, it was, if you will, a buyer's market. And in the intervening years, we've seen providers, particularly physicians, flee risk sharing. It's been a well-documented backlash of managed care, both by providers some consumers, or many consumers. In addition to, if you will, even those strategic business decisions, there's a change in market power just because that in the intervening 10 years, I remember a decade ago when, in fact, it was well written about that there were too many hospital beds in Portland. We were overbedded, if you will. And in many communities, hospitals were operating on a daily operating census that was much different than their license capacity. We've seen in many communities, however, that excess of hospital beds is gone. And I mentioned it here, but in the following one, is that there is indeed a shortage in selective specialties. So there is a change on the supply side that affects this market power issue, too. A lot has been on cost driver four. A lot has been written about, and Oregon has done a lot of planning in the area of workforce shortages. The shortage of nurses nationwide and in the state has clearly been well documented, along with a number of medical technicians, therapists, dental hygienists, and assistants, and other selected medical specialties. Part of this is, in fact, that the workforce in healthcare is aging, and I think then there's statistics available from the Oregon Nurses Association, the American Nurses Association, that the average age of the nurse workforce is, you know, pretty near retirement. And the influx of people into nursing or into other, these other medical technical areas that are really very good family wage jobs, there's a lot of new opportunities in this economy, particularly in information technology, where bright young people are going there, whereas two decades ago, they may have gone into healthcare.
Yes, Senator Marcet.
Yeah. I was waiting for you to talk about the planning that you said we're doing, because we can't train nurses in Oregon fast enough.
Well,
that's a problem, and
yeah,
I don't know how we're going to solve that.
The planning that I refer to is that there have been, I think, over at least the last two sessions, maybe even dating back farther, a whole lot of work done through the executive branch and with support of the legislature in workforce planning and healthcare. And I have a couple of colleagues that work particularly in the community college, and much more work is going on between working at the community college level and with the four-year baccalaureate colleges to get, one, what we need is we need more resources in those venues to train. There's also a shortage of actually faculty in many of these areas because what we pay MA or PhD a nurse faculty, they can make twice that much being a nurse, or a nurse administrator. But there is, I think there's beginning to be an understanding of what we need to put in place in an infrastructure sense. Now, have we funded it yet? Have we begun to fill that pipeline? No, but I think what I'm hopeful about is that there is a new form of coordination going on between a lot of these institutions that didn't happen before.
I appreciate your remarks, and I hope that that's true, because I've had this conversation over and over and over with my community college, Lane Community College, and they just tell me that there's no way that they can afford to have the classes, and there's a huge waiting list. In fact, I keep asking the question, maybe you can find out for me, what is the waiting list in the state of Oregon for getting into a nurse's program? I'd love to know that answer. How many people are waiting to get into the program that we desperately need?
I'll work through Bruce's office to get information from, and there may be somebody in the audience. One of the issues is not, I mean, the waiting list is actually, I mean, if we had everybody in the pipeline, qualified applicants. Yeah. I think one of the serious problems is, do we have enough faculty? Do we have enough infrastructure to move them through?
We don't.
Well, I know that there's a lot of in some community colleges they're looking at this as a specialty niche for educational opportunities. I know that the Oregon Institute of Technology, of course, OHSU and its nursing programs have done a lot of outreach and things like that. We need to do more of that.
Just to let the committee know, on February 25th, we are going to be having our committee meeting in Gresham, Oregon, and that will be our sole focus, is the healthcare workforce shortage. And so I think a lot of information will be coming forward to us then.
Well, may I please? Yeah, I really think what we need to do is have an in-depth analysis to define the problem and then to propose some possible solution, because we've been talking about this since I've been here since 99, and nothing has happened. And when I talk to the community colleges, they say nothing is going to happen on our end until we get more money. I mean, that's their simple answer. We can't, there are not enough faculty to teach. We can't afford the classes. So we all know that. And I haven't heard of any group doing the critical analysis that needs to be done.
We will hear that report on February 25th from a number of people that they have been working on it over the interim.
Yeah. Okay. I think there's a blueprint. Probably there may not be the money to build the building, but the fifth cost driver, and having spent a good number of years in the commercial health insurance, the literature does point that health insurance is a contributing factor to, and particularly the nature of benefit design. Stuart Altman, who's a very recognized health services researcher, the quote there I put there is that it has shielded patients from much of the cost at the point of service. And in fact, over the last probably 25 years, you've seen insurance move from something that would be a random, insuring against a random or unexpected events, to really prepaid payment of routine services. Now, in large part, there's a market response to this, and I'll get back to it. But it's also part of the culture of this country, is that there is an expectation that somehow insurance is going to take care of everything, and there's very little of one's own personal disposable income that goes into that. This is the kind of the pause before you ask for the MRI. Some people use the term, do they have financial skin in the game to be able to say, well, will a CT do the same thing? Cost driver six is capital spending. This is kind of an interesting one in the sense that we've gone for years and not had capital spending really be on the radar screen, but this and the slide that the the page after it, which is a snapshot from national data of the average annual growth in construction spending from the prior year. This is on a national basis. Now, I know that this phenomena, people can look at it from several different lenses, and I'm not putting it on the table here to say that there's an answer. Part of this answer is, in fact, the replacement of aging equipment and facilities.
Do you know what percent?
No, I don't, Madam Chair.
Would there be any?
But I do know. I mean, if you look around your own town, if you drive around in communities, hospitals and other ambulatory surgery centers, other facility-based kinds of health care, their physical plant has a natural life cycle to it, 25, 30 years. You can push it out to 50 years with major renovations and things like that. We do have natural cycles in capital spending that follow the if you will, the life cycle of plant and equipment. That is in part some of it. I don't know what portion of it. The other part is that I talked about at one point we were underbedded. Hospitals and other healthcare providers look at the same demographic relative. What are the number of hospital beds? What are the number of X, fill in whatever it is? Are we going to need in 2015, 2020 to serve the estimated population that's going to be in our service area? So part of that is, in fact, investing for the future to be able to meet that need. I don't know what portion of that is, and I know there are debates about is it necessary, if some of it's reasonable, is some of it unreasonable. I don't want to go there because I don't think that's my role, but to point out that capital spending is back on there, partly because of the nature of aging plant and equipment, and the last one partly because of the whole issue of information technology.
And with like OHSU has had a horrendous amount of building going on, I mean, is their cost reflected in this huge jump in O2, or is it just our hospitals?
Again, this is national data taken from across the nation, looking at
across the
nation. It's an annual snapshot of where healthcare spending is going, and I kind of picked this out because it stuck out that as we hear lots of debates about does this new hospital need to be built or is this renovation necessary, et cetera, that this is a phenomena. It's not unlike if you go back as a very young student of healthcare policy to the old Hill Burton in the post-war era, hospitals in this country were in fact built with federal grants named after Senator Hill and Representative Burton to build the infrastructure that we have now in the communities, and they had to work off that gift from the federal government through charity care. We've been through one cycle post-Hill Burton capital construction, probably in the heyday of the planning era in the 70s and 80s. We've been through all of that, and now we're confronting again another part of aging plant equipment. I think the other piece is, and it's the solution side to the information technology. Is information technology is clearly cheaper than it was 10 years ago. Many of our problems in moving information around in healthcare can be solved by information technology, but particularly for larger institutions. It's expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And I've worked for an organization that has basically 450,000 people on an electronic medical record. It's a wonderful tool. It improves the quality of care and the movement of information around, but it is no small investment to get there. And that's really a vision for the country, and I think Senator Frist in the Senate and others have talked about that's where we need to go, but it will come with a price. And hopefully there will be savings that come as a result of that type of investment.
Did you want to say?
Well, yeah, Barney kind of covered some of it. I mean, if you go back to Hill Burton in the 50s and you look at cycles, certainly that can tie into this. But, because there was a lot of infrastructure built then. It's been upgraded once. In some cases, it hasn't been.
Yeah.
And after 50 years, it is running out, and they're having to do it. But it's also, and I go to my own hospital with new technologies that are available, and the demand on those technologies. It was a point where the hospital had to step up their plate and start capital construction because there was no other place to do it. You know, our other hospitals are Medford and Eugene, and they're full. And so we either offered it or it doesn't exist. And so demand's driving a lot of the infrastructure costs that we're seeing right now.
Cost driver 7, there's always a role for government in some of this problem. This committee and others in this building, I think, are pretty aware that Medicare and Medicaid policy do have an impact in what happens in the commercial market and the self-pay market, called the cost shift. In this state and any other state where contractions happen in Medicaid, you see not only the problem in the first bullet of Medicare Medicaid payment is kind of underpayment. The problem of the second bullet is no payment. So total uncompensated care. Those policies and the impact of those policies on the marketplace are real. Under new regulation, I make the point of HIPAA, which is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. It was very costly for the healthcare industry to implement HIPAA, the HIPAA privacy regulations. I want to point out, and this is kind of the Hobbesian kinds of issues that one confronts in this policy arena and elsewhere, is that aspect. I'm not saying that the HIPAA privacy wasn't a good thing, but it was costly. Another aspect of HIPAA, which was what's called the HIPAA transaction codes, which is basically the way I describe it, is it's a national electronic language that we all are ultimately going to use to verify eligibility, send bills in, make payments, all done electronically, getting rid of the paper entirely. That's a good thing. The unfortunate thing to get to a national electronic language has taken us a decade, and we're not there yet. It's a complex system. There's all sorts of opportunities to slow it down. In a real market, like in banking, with ATMs, I think within less than 10 years, and probably in 5 years, we revolutionized commercial banking by how the industry agreed to talk to each other with the use of a debit card and an ATM, and, if you will, digital as opposed to paper. I'm hopeful that we will continue to move both the public sector and private sector to be able to do that easiest aspect of electronic communications. Tax policy has an impact on healthcare. It's long written about in this country. Employer-based coverage is a totally deductible expense, if you will. It lessens the revenue to the federal and state government because it's deductible. But there's no limits on it. If you buy the most inefficient healthcare insurance policy, you get more of a deduction than others. That one is a federal issue, quite candidly. Cost driver 8, I use the term primitive systems of care. Dr. Goldberg talked about this. There's a couple things going on within particularly the last 10 or 15 years, and I think we'll continue to see it, is that the American healthcare model from the 40s, 50s, the post-war era through the 80s, built around an acute care model. We're increasingly, because of the longevity, because of where medical science has taken us, we're managing patients with chronic care, and often multiple chronic care, on an ambulatory basis. And so the complexity of managing these kinds of cases across numerous, perhaps, healthcare professionals in different locations, et cetera, makes a system of care even more necessary. I won't spend too much time on the issue of paper versus electrons. You heard I didn't have the factoid about 90% of the information moves by paper, but clearly, whenever we have paper, what I call the handoff from a doctor to a pharmacist, the handoff to a doctor to another doctor, if paper's involved, there's a high probability that the paper won't get there when the patient does, or that there's something that can't be read, et cetera, et cetera. Cost driver 9, medical legal environment. The only point that I want to make here really is the second one. Probably the area of cost that's been most written about and least understood is exactly what's the cost of defensive medicine. We know it's embedded in the system. We don't know how big it is, but it clearly plays a role. I'd point out here, and I just reiterate the role of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission, which was passed last session, and I think it's a good first step. It's being done basically by the healthcare industry, broadly defined, and will address, I hope, over time, some of the issues that Dr. Goldberg pointed out in the errors of, in the issue of errors in healthcare delivery. Those are 9 cost drivers. I would recommend. I want to give a plug to my Dr. Goldberg is UPR Administrator 4. I was UPR Administrator 2. Most recent report that came out from his office, the January 2005. But there is a section in here on health care drivers. Speaks about almost all of the ones that I've mentioned. I wish I had written it, but I never got a master's degree and could do footnotes. So they've got all the footnotes here that take you back into the literature. Quickly, as a segue to the next part of the presentation, is there have been responses. There are markets respond, even inefficiently ill working markets respond. Employer sponsored coverage. You've heard about increased cost sharing, premiums, deductibles, and coinsurance. There's a whole new generation of healthcare products with a whole new set of acronyms, CDHPs, or consumer driven health policies or health plans, HSAs, health savings accounts, HRAs, health reimbursement accounts. But there's a whole new era of health insurance benefit plan design, much more done on disease management, trying to address the issues that I talked about, management of complex chronic diseases like diabetes and asthma. And clearly employers, I think, their strategy is to move to, in healthcare, instead of paying for a defined benefit, moving toward a defined contribution. Same thing, the last slide, Madam Chair, is the same thing, that if you don't have group coverage, the same thing's happening in individual coverage, that is coverage purchased in a commercial market by an individual or a family relative to the nature of the products are there. Lastly, I have a little chart that again borrowed from Dr. Altman, that just lays out that from his perspective some of the new cost drivers and the roles and tools that various players in the healthcare dynamic, purchasers, insurers, providers, and government are looking at. So I'm going to stop there. I'm just about out of time, and I'd be happy to answer questions, and I appreciate the opportunity to have been able to talk to you today.
Thank you, Mr. Spate. This gives us a good foundation on addressing cost containment.
Thank you. I found a watch here, too, so.
All right, now should we have Joel and Rocky King, Joel Ario and Rocky King come?
He's up more than four guys in therapy outside. Found him writing down good.
He knows what covering is.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Ario, the administrator of the insurance division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm going to cover the regulated health insurance marketplace, and then Rocky's going to talk some about some of the more innovative programs we have to try to deal with some of our uninsurance and affordability problems. The regulated insurance market in Oregon includes 823 health insurers or health care service contractors, so it's a big marketplace of insurers and healthcare service contractors. But when you look into the details of the market, most of the coverage is provided by a handful of Oregon domestic companies. More than 80% of the market is with the large Oregon domestics. We're talking Regions, Kaiser, Pacific Care, Pacific Source, HealthNet, and ODS. Most of the coverage is provided by those companies. So we're fortunate to have primarily a domestic-based industry here. When we have issues that we need to talk about, work out, we're able to sit down with the domestic carriers. There are then hundreds of national carriers who are part of our market, but most of them have very targeted sectors of the market that they work with. They're kind of niche players in the marketplace. In terms of what we regulate in the marketplace, there are three primary markets that we focus on. Individual, which is about 200,000 people here in Oregon, buying individual coverage. That can include family or dependent coverage as well. Small group coverage, which is about 250,000 people in that market. There are two parts of that, the two groups up to 25. We have quite aggressive regulation of those groups. And then we have some regulation of the 26 to 50 sized groups. And all of that together comprises the small group market. And then we have something called the portability market, which is people coming out of group coverage or people moving into the state that had coverage in other states, they have some rights to have continued coverage if they do it within the right period of time. And that market is about 16,000 people, so it's a much smaller slice of the market. You add that all up, and the markets that we regulate are the about 500,000 Oregonians, or about 15% of the state's population. You heard earlier that there were 1.5 million people in the public markets and in uninsurance. So that you take the 1.5 million that Bruce and Bob talked about, you get down to 2 million, you take our 500,000, that leaves you 1.5 million people in the state. They are in large groups, typically insured through their employer. Some of those are through insurance companies, through insured products, and some of them are self-insured. Because we don't regulate those large groups, except as to their insurance forms, we do not have precise statistics on how many people in that 1.5 million are insured people versus how many are self-insured. And oftentimes, interestingly enough, the employees themselves wouldn't know, because if you take, say, a large company like Intel, they may have a set of choices that their employees can choose from. Some of them may be self-insured products where the company itself is carrying the risk. Some of them may be insurance products. They may offer Kaiser, for instance, as an insurance product. All of them probably have an insurance company or something like an insurance company actually administering the benefit program there. So from the employee's perspective, they still have a Regions card or an ODS card or whatever. But the difference is, if it's an insured product, means the insurance company is on the hook for the risk, and then they have to comply with certain requirements of the insurance code, like the mandates. If it's a self-insured plan where all they're doing is administering the program and the company has the risk, so they pay whatever comes forward, there's no risk transfer, then they're doing just administration of the program, what's called third-party administration or TPA administration, and we don't have any regulatory authority over that kind of product. So I'm going to focus most of my comments then now on the 500,000 people that we actually do effectively and aggressively regulate. And by the way, I'll say that there's rhyme or reason to this, in that though the individual, small group, and portability sectors are the ones where people in past times have come to this legislature, particularly in the 1990s, and said, we're having problems finding insurance or being treated fairly in the insurance marketplace, and that's why we have the regulation of those three markets. Groups above 25, by and large, have not been in front of the legislature saying that they have a difficult time getting health insurance for themselves and so forth. So those are the markets that haven't yet been regulated. Now, I know you're going to look at some proposals here that would apply more regulation, but in the past reform efforts, the large bulk of the energy and focus has been on those, the individual and small employers, which really do have a very difficult time sometimes finding insurance and being able to negotiate.
When you say regulation, what do you mean? What are you regulating?
Two kinds of things we regulate in the marketplace. One is the insurance policies themselves. We call that form regulation. And the most important type of regulation of insurance policies is the mandate regulation. So the legislature says there has to be this kind of mental health benefit or this maternity coverage or whatever. One of the things we make sure all of those policies then contain is those mandates. And there are some other requirements that are part of the insurance code about fair treatment of the consumer that have to be incorporated in those insurance contracts. The other kind of regulation we do is rate regulation. And that differs for each of the three sectors that we were talking about here, the individual, portability, and small group. But essentially, what we do through our rate regulation in the small group market is ensure that all small groups are put into one big pool. and all are part of the same pool. So if you contrast what happens in large groups, basically large groups, any group over 25, is negotiating the rate for that group with the insurance carrier, usually through a broker, and the primary determinant of what they're going to pay for a rate is the group's own experience.
Available for the small group market?
What's available for the small group is, because those groups don't have past experience and so forth, they can't be rated on that. The legislature has passed statutes that say that all the small groups have to be pooled together in one big pool, and then those 250,000 lives are rated through what we call modified community rating, meaning that there are only certain ways you can't charge those groups based on their own experience. You can't charge them based on any other health-related factors. What you can charge them on is the age of the employees, the family composition, differences in the benefit structure that's provided to the groups. Those are the primary things. Even there, there's restrictions that you have to keep all of the groups. The most expensive group in a particular insurer's portfolio cannot be charged more than twice what the least expensive group is. So there are even restrictions on, say, the way this works is if there weren't that rate regulation, small groups with older workers would pay more, and small groups with young workers would pay less. But because of the statutes, it sort of forces everybody towards a common rate. And in essence, the way I look at it is it forces the small group market to behave like a large employer would behave. Say for the state of Oregon, we're all pooled in one, as state employees, we're all pooled in one pool. And I'm now getting the benefit of, even though I'm on the older side of things, I don't pay any more for health insurance than somebody who's half my age in the department, because it's all pooled together as a large employer. So in essence, what the laws do with the small employer market is force that same kind of pooling so that people pay closer to the same rates in that small employer market. In the individual market, we have rate regulation as well, but it's a little different. And then in the small employer market, the other important point to make is that the insurers are required to take all comers. So if they have products out there that they offer to one small group, they have to offer those products to any small group that comes forward, and they have to offer it on those same rating terms and all other terms. So that's what's called guaranteed issue. They can't look at a group of two or a group of ten and say, gee, you got a couple people here who are pretty unhealthy, or your group is, you know, mostly 60 and 62-year-olds, and we're not going to insure you. Every group has to be taken on with all of the products that are available in that insurer's portfolio in that market. With the individual market, there's a different situation. There, in that market, the insurer can say, we're going to do a health statement on you, and if you don't pass our health statement, then we're going to send you over to one of Rocky's programs, to the high-risk pool. So the insurance companies do not have to insure people that they don't want to insure in the individual market. But it is regulated because you cannot, all carriers have to use exactly the same health statement, and if they say yes to somebody in the market, they have to rate them according to fairly strict requirements that only allow them to use certain kinds of variables to rate, and they can't rate them on, for instance, their health status. So they can't charge people more just because they're sick. Charge people more because they're older, but not because they're sick. So there are restrictions in that market as well. And then the final market where we have rate regulation is portability, and those people have to basically be rated the same way as the group coverages are rated. So they have to be pooled in with group coverages. So in each of those markets, then, we first of all make sure that the insurance contracts are fair to the consumer, that they include the mandates and so forth. And then we secondly implement and enforce the rate regulation that the legislature has given us, that essentially forces people into pools and doesn't allow the insurance companies to look at people, this is a sick person, I'm going to segregate them over here, and that sort of thing. So,
yeah, Senator Cruz.
Just for clarification, who is exempt from formal rate regulation?
Pardon?
Who is exempt from form regulation?
Self-insured.
And not at all.
Yes. The largest group, if a corporation with 5,000 employees is offering an insured product, then that insurance contract has to comply with the insurance code and the mandates as much as a small employer contract. There's a little bit of a technical exception to that for so-called unique contracts that can be negotiated, and we don't officially have to review and approve those, but they still do have to include the mandates.
Okay, I guess, I mean, because you said somebody like Intel that offers a variety of packages, so some of them you have form regulation over and some you don't. I mean, how do you differentiate that? I mean,
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, excuse me. The way we regulate is through the insurance company. So if the insurance company is offering an insurance policy to an Intel employee, and in some cases they may be, there may be choices on their menu that are insured products, then the insurance company is who we look to make sure that their contracts follow the law. If the insurance company is simply providing TPA services, third-party administrator services to that contract, then they, in that context, that benefit contract could say whatever Intel wanted to negotiate because it wouldn't be a regulated contract.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have about 10 minutes before we have to get out of this room for the next committee. So.
May want to hear from my colleague, Rocky King, then.
May.
Will. Should.
Go for it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Insurance Pool Governing Board and the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, and I'm batting cleanup. But somebody pointed out to me today that batting ninth for the Houston Astros is Roger Clemens, and he's the best in the team. So,
but he can't hit worth a damn. So.
I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about some of the public-private partnership programs that the state has, starting with the Insurance Pool Governing Board, and there are really three components to that. The certified health plans for small employers, and I almost want to invite the chair down to help me give this because she knows probably as much about it as I do. Also want to talk about the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, FEOP, some of the information, education, and outreach we do under IPGB and OMIP, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, the state's high-risk pool that Joel talked about. Real briefly, and I will go through these rather fast because, quite frankly, I think most of you have a pretty good grounding in these programs. But the 2003 legislature directed the Insurance Pool Governing Board to develop a low-cost plan, some people call it light on the mandates, to try to encourage small uninsured businesses who had been uninsured since July of 2003 to purchase group health insurance for their employees or their dependents or their children. The board worked for a little over a year to develop those plans and have come up with, I think, some innovative proposals that we're starting to put out on the street as we speak. The first thing they did was to develop what's called an alternative group plan, and basically they targeted a premium that would be about 30% cheaper than what most group health insurance products are sold for out in the regular market. But the only way you can get a 30% decrease in premium is either cost shifting, that is increasing cost sharing, reducing some of the benefits, limitations on some of the benefits, or in some cases just eliminating those benefits. And the board did that to what I think is just a basic plan that is targeted more towards the young and healthy workers that very often are uninsured in some of these very small businesses that do not provide group health insurance. At the same time they did that, though, they had a real strong feeling that while adults can make a choice, I want a good plan or a bad plan or a catastrophic plan, children can't. So they wanted to make sure that while adults made an explicit choice to buy what would be a reduced benefit plan, that they didn't impose that on the children. So they developed what's called the Children's Group Plan, which really, and there's information in the packet for you to look at that lays out some of the benefits, but it's a really good comprehensive plan, better than most group plans actually out there sold today. terms of cost sharing, very low co-pays on drugs and immunizations and well baby care, some of the preventative services. What we wanted to do was offer those uninsured businesses four choices. One, you can come in and cover just the employees, and it's not a great plan, but at least some coverage. Number two, you could do the employees and the spouses. Again, not a great plan, but some coverage. Three, you could provide everything for the whole family, the alternative plan for the adults and the children's plans for the children. And the fourth option, which is really kind of turning the equation upside down, is if you can't do anything for your employee and you can't do anything for the employee's spouse, can you step up and at least cover the children of your employees? And most business, almost all group business today, if you talk to a health insurance agent, they go to the employee or employer and say, won't you buy coverage for your employees? And they make a decision and usually have nothing left over, especially in the small employers, to do anything for the dependents. We're just trying to reverse that equation and say, okay, they're young and healthy, fine, how about the kids? And we're going to see how it works. It becomes effective March 1st. We're out in 25 cities during this last 2 weeks of February and the first couple weeks of March, from Longview to Ontario to Coos Bay to up the I-5 corridor. And we'll be training about 1,000 to 1,100 agents around this as well as our other plans. We know when the governor had their news conference that Blue Cross received several hundred calls over that following week asking for information. We know that some quotes are starting to go out, but it's way early. I mean, it's in 3 weeks into this process. You have to get information out, applications filled out and in. So we're hoping that it's going to make a difference, and I don't know how many people are going to enroll. If I get one kid covered, I'll be smiling. If I get 5,000, I'll be going out for a steak dinner. But we're pretty excited about trying this, and it's really a public-private partnership. We only had two carriers, Regents Blue Cross, Blue Shield of Oregon, and HealthNet, and I want to again thank them publicly. Every carrier was invited to participate in this initiative, and those two stepped up into what is a rather risky market, and I think they should be commended for participating. But we'll be coming back throughout the session as we meet in some of the budget committees and some of our bills and let you know what's going on there. The other program, FEOP, Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, established in 1997, expanded in 2002 with getting federal waivers and federal dollars into the program. It has had its ups and downs politically, enrollment-wise, because of a lot of different decisions that have taken place between the 99 sessions and the last session, 2003. But we're now open for business, group and individual, and we have grown tremendously in the last 4 or 5 months. We actually, beginning July of this year, abandoned the policy of just focusing on group and are now allowing people from the individual, only have individual coverage available to them, to come in. We're now at about 9,000 enrollments. We have another 2,900 that have been approved that are out there seeking coverage now, and we have about 2,000 people that have applications in-house that we're trying to finish and get out there so they can find some insurance. We hope by the end of the biennium that we'll be somewhere between 13 and 15,000 enrolled. We're at the highest level we've ever been at 9,000 today. So we're really hopeful. And for those that don't know the program, it subsidizes, again, the purchase of private health insurance, either on the group side or the individual side, depending what's available to them. We pay anywhere from 50 to 95% of the premium, and those individuals have to earn under 185% of the poverty level, be uninsured for a period of 6 months, and are responsible for all co-pays, deductibles. They take care of anything, but they carry a Blue Cross card or an ODS card or a Pacific Care card just like you and I do. So they just are a little bit different than the normal public programs. Information, education, and outreach. With all that's been going on with the economy, with what's been going on with the reduction in the standard population, we've seen, and some of the marketing we've been doing around the certified plans as well as FEOP, our office, we have five people that man the phones, and we've seen in the last 3 to 4 months, the average number of phone calls come into our office go from 1,000 to 1,200 up to about 3,000 a week. I will tell you there are a lot of people out there that are scrambling, trying to find something, whether it's a small employer, whether it's an individual. The economy has really impacted people's ability to find different workable options for them to get health insurance. So from a customer service standpoint, we get almost 10 to 12,000 calls a month, and we refer those people out. We have an agent referral system, for example. If a small employer calls and says, what do I do? We have trained throughout the state. Every year we go out and do the training agents, and we certify them so we can give agent referrals. We're averaging 35 agent referrals a day right now to individuals and small businesses looking for assistance in their local communities to enroll in health insurance. Again, we do the training, the agent referrals, and just basically try to help people fit into some place into the system, whether it be on the public side or the private side. OMIP, the high-risk pool, we're one of 31 states, started in 1990, served over 35,000 Oregonians, currently with an enrollment of about 10,600. A lot of people say, well, how many people would be eligible or should qualify? Best estimates on a national basis is it's generally about 3% of your uninsured population. So we probably have about 18,000 people out there that would qualify for the pool, and our penetration of that is about 60%, which is one of the highest in the country. But if you work for Tektronix and you're a diabetic, you got health insurance, and it's great, and they pay it and everything else. But if you are a house cleaner and going around the city cleaning people's houses and have to go to the individual market and have diabetes, you can't get coverage. And that's the purpose of the pool. MS, multiple sclerosis, cancer, heart disease, almost any chronic health care condition you can name, people can come to the pool on a guaranteed issued basis if they're turned down in the regular market because of those health conditions, and we can serve them. It's interesting statistics, though. It's 60% female, and average age is over 50 years old. So you have a lot of folks out there, and these are people that can afford to pay premiums, but you have a lot of folks out there that are married, for example, to folks that are working for employers that don't provide dependent coverage. So their only option is the individual market. And if you're over 40 and you try to get into the individual market, the chances of you not having a health condition are pretty slim, and you'll probably be denied. So we get a lot of those folks. Again, this is a public-private partnership. About 35 to 40% of our funding comes from an assessment of insurers, while the remaining comes from the premiums of those individuals. And we have five insurers on the board, and I want to tell you, I've been there for 15 years, and they have stepped up twice a year to help fund this pool. They choke sometimes when they make that vote, but I have to commend the industry for standing behind this pool as we've seen the population grow over the years. It's a good program, and I think does a good job.
How much do they pay?
The assessment,
or the OMIP.
The assessment, Madam Chair, for the last 6 months was approximately $14 to $15 million, and that is spread out among, I want to say, about 180 insurers. However, you could name the top six, seven domestic insurers pay about 90% of that assessment, with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield the largest, who is also the third-party administrator for this. They handle the day-to-day claims and eligibility case and disease management for us, and Kaiser would be the second largest that contributes towards that assessment.
We have to...
Can I just ask one short question? You've talked about the market increase and calls you're getting. Can you tie that? I don't know when your radio outreach started. I think it's a pretty good program. Is there a tie there at all?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz. I didn't want to goof on that one. We have a couple things. We've been working with Baker Schools out there. And we went down to Roseburg and did some things. Baker City, the Dalles, the television commercials with Bill Shonley, who's given his time to help support this program over the years. We're just doing a lot of things, the certified plans, the agent training, mm-hmm. all of that, plus standard. I mean, when you look at FEOP, about 30, I'm going to get this figure wrong, about 30% of those people coming into FEOP right now earn under 100% of the federal poverty level. We're getting a lot of those folks that are coming over because standards closed that would normally go there that are coming to the FEOP program. The problem is, as we all know, the private health insurance market is much more difficult to navigate and includes co-pays, deductibles that can be significant compared to OHB standards. So to some degree, we're getting only those folks that have the capacity to navigate the private health care system.
Senator Courtney?
How well do you know baseball, Mr. King?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, did I goof on my...
I could be wrong. Thank you, Chair Montanez. You said you were batting cleanup, and you referred to the ninth batter as Roger Clemens. It's my understanding that the ninth, the cleanup hitter is the fourth hitter in the lineup,
yes,
and the most feared and revered hitter in all the nine hitters. Do you understand that situation?
I understand that, Senator Courtney.
Thank you so much. So obviously you are the best performer here today, by the your performance runs. I just thought I'd say
Roger Clemens was the most feared pitcher, though.
Madam Chair, I'm a golfer, and I just made a bogey.
Meeting adjourned.
12th Policy Committee meeting of February 16th. I want to welcome all of you here. I'm so glad that we have such a great number. We thought that we wouldn't have more than 100 people, but it looks like we have quite a few now in hearing you see. Anyway, I wish we could all be in one room. This afternoon, we heard testimony from experts regarding the technical aspects and research around healthcare costs, issues and problems. We heard about the healthcare market, the role of health insurance, and what are really the healthcare cost drivers. But tonight we really want to put a human face on it, and we want people, and this is why we're having a public hearing. We really need to hear from people who are actually experiencing problems with our healthcare system, whether it's cost, people with or without insurance. And there is a, we have 2 hours, and it looks like we have several people, but after an hour, if we see that there's a long list, I may have to ask you to cut your testimony down. But right now, it looks like we'll be able to let everyone speak as long as you want. There is a sign-up sheet, and it's located on the table to my right. It's next to the wall, your left. And we will only call people up who have signed up on the list. Right now I have one list, so if there's another list, if you feel you want to testify, please sign up over there. You need to check the box next to where you sign up to indicate if you have traveled more than 100 miles to be here tonight. So, I think we're ready to go. The first person that I would like to call is Patrick Pine. Patrick is president of the Oregon Coalition of Healthcare Purchasers and Corporate Benefits Manager.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson and honored senators.
And Representative Dalto is here to be with us, too. He's not a part of the committee, but he's on the House side. I'm so glad that he's here. Yes, and please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Patrick Pine. I'm Corporate Benefits Manager for ESCO Corporation. I also serve as the chair of AOI's Health Policy Advisory Committee, and I'm the current president of the Oregon Health Care Purchasers Coalition. The purpose of my testimony this evening is to very briefly note some of the continuing pressures that regularly rising costs of health care benefits place on employers and their employees and families alike. In order to be brief, I think the most efficient way to illustrate the situation is to provide you some recent historical comparisons which illustrate what's happening in the form of a table that I think is being distributed to you that shows some typical insured plans offered by employers in Oregon and elsewhere 4 years ago and roughly where those costs lie today for a typical benefit plan. I will tell you that the numbers that I provide in that table that you may be looking at are generally conservative. They're probably lower than what is really the case today to a certain degree, but I still think they're generally representative. The table that I am providing you is broadly representative of averages. It is rounded for in order to give you what I call a order of magnitude type of overview. It's not precise. It's not based on any single source of data. It would be what I call a representative sample. The point of the display that I've distributed to you is to indicate three key points. First, for those employers who continue to provide what I'll call comprehensive benefit packages to their employees, the annual double-digit percentage increases are essentially doubling premium costs roughly every 4 to 5 years. These costs are increasing even after modifying benefit designs to increase co-pays, deductibles, and other means of increasing the amounts that individuals now pay for health services. These costs increasingly make it more difficult for U.S.-based companies to absorb these costs and remain competitive with those who do not incur such costs, both in the U.S. and elsewhere. For small companies, which Oregon is largely composed of, it is often unaffordable to continue coverage at all or to provide more than what I call very limited coverage for what may be considered catastrophic cost protection. The way that I and my peers must work to mitigate costs is to incrementally modify designs or reduce offerings and or ask our employees to contribute more towards the total cost. But even if we use all of these approaches, as we have, the employer is still faced with dramatic real dollar increases to offer reasonably competitive benefits. Each additional dollar that is spent on this category represents money that might otherwise be used to fulfill other needs, such as wage increases, or funding other benefits, or hiring additional employees, or making additional investments to improve productivity. While there are many possible future changes that may alleviate the problem in the longer term, frankly, most of these options do not provide near-term relief. For instance, health savings accounts seem to be gaining some market acceptance, but at this point, these plans cover perhaps less than 5% of the entire group population in the United States today. Predictions, even from the most ardent supporters of health savings accounts, indicate that even with substantial growth, these plans will cover less than 10% of the entire group market in the year 2007. That's even with good market acceptance. I will say that HSAs do appear to be very helpful to the very small company, which is a very important factor in Oregon, which is predominantly a small business state. But I would also point out that from the individual employee's perspective, even an employer that is continuing to offer fairly competitive benefit offerings is moving an increasing burden onto the employee relative to the recent past. Let me give you just one example. Using the table that I provided, let's assume you're an employee of company XYZ, and 4 years ago, you as an employee paid 10% of the family premium, which is maybe $550. You were then contributing $55 per month, and the company was contributing $495 a month of that total premium. So let's assume 4 years later, the total premium is now $950 a month. The company is now asking its employees to contribute, we'll say, 15% of the total. So you as an employer are now contributing $147.50 a month, up from $55 just 4 years ago. Meanwhile, your company is now paying $802.50 a month, up over $300 a month from 4 years ago. Meanwhile, you as the employee see that the office visit copay that was $5 4 years ago is probably $20 or more today. So even though the employer has increased its spending on the health care bill by over hundreds of dollars a month for each employee, the employee is still dissatisfied because he or she sees a substantial increase in his or her cost for what appear to be a less generous benefit. This scenario has been repeated and continues to occur to a greater or lesser degree at thousands of companies across the United States. The purpose of my testimony is not to support or oppose a particular piece of legislation this evening, but it is offered to provide some context about what's going on out there. It is also offered to explain one of the reasons that, I want to just talk about a couple of things, that AOI, for instance, has found it necessary to suggest that many well-intentioned suggested mandates for benefit plans are not necessarily positive when weighed against the overall continuing cost increase trends. For instance, if a particular mandate is estimated to add just 1% to overall cost of a group plan, at today's levels, a monthly premium for a family plan for a lot of plans is hovering in the $1,000 a month range. So a 1% increase equates to $10 per month in additional cost. That may not sound like much, but various studies done in Oregon and elsewhere suggest that a few hundred or a few thousand Oregonians will lose their group health coverage for every dollar of premium increase that is added onto the total bill today. So I would say in that case, I don't think we're being cold-hearted. Rather, we're suggesting that there's a very real difficult trade-off between benefiting a particular group with a compelling need at the real risk that others will lose their health insurance coverage altogether. So my comments are also intended to note that overall costs will continue to increase at the present time. There's no indication on the horizon of anything that's going to change that in the near term. While there has also been a tremendous amount of energy devoted to the cost of prescriptions, all of you have dealt with that and continue to deal with it. And despite all the attention to that, there are other cost components of the overall health care bill which are actually now rising faster than prescription drugs at a relative rate of increase. For instance, the Healthcare Purchasers Coalition probably created some contentious relations with our friends in the hospital industry with our past efforts to better understand how hospitals price their services. That issue has also become a national discussion recently. Debates about better ways to understand how hospitals establish prices have made it on the front page of publications like the Wall Street Journal. So what I can say, though, is that purchasers are generally united in a desire for greater transparency across the continuum of health care, whether we're talking about prescription drugs or hospital care. But I will also acknowledge to my friends in the hospital and the pharmaceutical industry that the nature of our payment mechanisms across the United States, a variety of legal issues and other factors, do make it quite difficult for health care providers, especially hospitals, to easily provide us information in the manner that we'd prefer to see it. I will say that I'm an optimist, however. I think everyone is very frustrated with this continuing cost increase pressures and the obstacles to addressing these pressures, but I, for one, and I think many of my peers still believe that at least in Oregon, we can still find a way to collaboratively address these issues in a very constructive manner. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any discussion? All right. Thank you so much. Would Leslie Frame come in? And Leslie is the executive director at SEIU, Local 503.
Thank you very much, Senator Montes Anderson, and all the members of the committee for giving me the opportunity to testify this evening. As Senator Montes Anderson said, I'm Leslie Frame, the executive director at SEIU Local 503, and our union represents about 35,000 members in Oregon, 21,000 of whom work for the state of Oregon and receive health insurance through PEB, the Public Employee Benefit Board. Like all of us here today, we are very concerned about the rising costs of health care. Over the years, our union has worked hard to further PEB's mission, which is to, quote, provide a high-quality plan of health and other benefits for state employees at a cost affordable to both employees and the state. Now more than ever, fulfilling that mission presents enormous challenges. In 2001, PEB paid an average of $470 per member per month for state employee health benefits. 4 years later, costs have nearly doubled. They now average $818 per member per month, and that adds up to a total state expenditure of $435 million for 110,000 state employees and their families. While these numbers are enormous, it's worth noting that the increases that they reflect are very much in line with increases seen by other employers across the state. But it's not just the employer that's paying more for health care. State employees covered through PEB have seen our out-of-pocket costs skyrocket at an even faster rate than premium costs have risen. In 2003, and that's the most recent year for which data is available, employees insured by PEB paid an average of $800 a year in out-of-pocket costs, and that was up from $400 a year in 1999, so it doubled in 4 years. Much of this increase results from changes in plan design, changes that have shifted costs to employees through mechanisms such as higher copayments. One area in which PEB has done an exemplary job of controlling costs is on the administrative front. Administrative overhead consumes just 0.6% of PEB premiums. Compare this to the private sector, in which administrative costs average 11.7%. But controlling administrative costs is not enough. Cost increases like the ones we've seen in the past few years are unsustainable for the state and for our members alike. Recognizing the seriousness of the crisis we face, in 2002, the PEB board began work on a 5-year vision and plan. This vision recognized that the current healthcare system is broken and that this breakdown puts both healthcare quality and affordability at risk. Currently, PEB is working to design a plan to realize its 5-year vision. Key components of the plan include an innovative delivery system in communities statewide that provides evidence-based medicine to maximize health and utilize dollars wisely. It provides for system-wide transparency through explicit, available, and understandable reports about costs, outcomes, and other useful data. And it provides benefits that are affordable to the state and to employees. To achieve this vision, PEB created a new RFP process for the 2006 benefit year. Through this RFP, PEB is demanding better coordination of care for our members and alignment of consumer incentives and plan designs. The board is also considering carving out its prescription drug benefit into a separate plan and purchasing drugs through the prescription drug purchasing pool created during the last legislative session. PEB's vision is impressive, and its plan has already gained national recognition as a model that can help to reduce costs and to protect, and in fact to improve, healthcare quality. However, we believe that we must go further. Between 2000 and 2003, PEB's expenditures on inpatient hospital stays jumped by 43%, while utilization of inpatient services increased by just 7.4%. At the same time, the cost per claim for outpatient care increased by 28%, and the cost for prescription drugs increased by 30%. In every single category, cost is outpacing utilization by frightening margins. To solve this problem, we need your help. We need legislation that will control prescription drug prices, that will increase accountability in the insurance industry, and will ensure fair hospital pricing. The Affordable Health Care Package, Senate Bills 501 through 505, sponsored by Chair Monis Anderson and Senator Morissette, would enact reforms necessary to reduce health care costs for Oregon businesses, working families, and the state. For instance, we have estimated that Senate Bill 502, the Fair Hospital Pricing Bill, would reduce the growth rate of hospital costs from 6.2% annually to 5% annually, producing an annual savings statewide of about $190 million. We're looking forward to working with you to enact these common sense cost-saving measures. As the largest purchaser of health care in this state, PEB can lead the way for other employers and help reduce health care costs for all Oregonians. But we caution that cutting health care benefits or shifting more costs to employees does not accomplish this goal. Employers around the country have tried this strategy, and they have failed. Reducing coverage levels or shifting premium costs to employees treats the symptoms rather than the cause of the problem. Likewise, the approach that has been euphemistically touted as consumer-driven health care is really about transferring costs. In this case, transferring costs to those with the most serious health problems who are required to pay much more to obtain the coverage level that their families need. The real way to solve the budget shortfall and the health care crisis is actually to lower costs, not just to transfer them, by demanding greater accountability and cost savings from the hospitals, the insurance companies, and the pharmaceutical companies that have repeatedly overcharged the state and wasted tax dollars. The affordable health care package will move us toward that goal. On behalf of our members, we urge its passage. Thank you. The bill, yes. We call it the 500 series bills. I'm excited about them because it is the first set of bills that have really been proposed that really address what we call cost containment. We have to look at cost containment. There's no magic bullet. If there was, you know, we would have implemented it long ago. So I'm excited. We are working. We're going to deal with this. We have the stakeholders meeting on this, and we'll see what can happen with them. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Further discussion? All right. Okay. Let me call Ellen Pinn. Oh, yeah, Penny and James Richards, if you could come up together. Okay. Oh, when we have a public hearing, we don't, it's not... We don't allow clapping, even though we would love to clap. So, just wave your hand. Yeah, just send everyone.
We don't allow booing either. So.
Yeah, no booing either.
No lighting of libraries.
Okay, who wants to go first? Okay,
I'll go first. For the record, my name is Ellen Kinney, and I'm the director of the Oregon Health Action Campaign, and with me tonight are Jim Richards and Heather Sorensen, who is the next person on the list. And I just wanted to provide a little context for what you're going to hear from them. The Oregon Health Action Campaign is a coalition of organizations and individuals, and we're committed to empowering the consumer voice in the development of health systems that give all people access to the care they need when they need it from providers of their choice at an affordable cost. We operate a health helpline. It's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week service that is run by our staff person. It's bilingual, and we offer ourselves as a resource for people who need help figuring out how to pay their medical bills, whether that be hospital bills or need help trying to get prescription drugs who don't have prescription drug coverage. We also help people get enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan who have challenges with the application and try to help with navigation issues once folks are enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. The people who are with me tonight came to us through that helpline and the work that we do in the community. These stories reveal the reasons that over 50% of the bankruptcies filed in this country are related to medical debt. But they do not reveal the fastest reason for medical debt bankruptcies, the fastest growing reason, which is actually underinsurance. People whose insurance does not meet their needs. These folks reveal, their stories reveal what happens to people without health insurance when they are faced with a medical crisis. And what I don't think you're going to be able to see unless you look closely at those bills is that folks without health insurance are asked to pay the highest rate. Nobody else pays or is asked to pay the amount of money for their hospital bills or their pharmaceutical costs as are people without health insurance. I am delighted that these two people who are facing family and emotional and physical trauma have committed to making it here tonight to share their stories with you in hopes that it will shed some light on what really happens when you're faced with the kind of costs that you're going to be hearing about.
Good evening. My name is James Richards. I live in Falls City with my wife and my 3-year-old son, Noah. Our income is $1,500 a month. It used to be very different. A car accident changed my life forever. Everybody in this room's life could be changed by the same thing that happened to me. I have many problems to face now. I juggle over $240,000 in medical expenses. That should not be one of them. That's why I made this trip tonight. I'm hoping that you people can change this. Until my accident, I worked as a heavy equipment oiler and truck driver. Last October, I broke my back. I can't work. My income has dropped from $60,000 a year to $18,000. Healthcare costs aside, we barely have enough money, income, to cover our mortgage, electric, phone, and our water bill. The medications I need cost over $500 a month, even with the drug discounts that I get from Ameriplan. I understand this hearing is about health care cost. Let me share some of mine with you. I owe the largest percentage of my medical bills to OHSU. In addition, I owe $7,316 to the anesthesiologist, $10,480 to Salem Hospital and Ambulance Services, $14,422 to OHSU medical doctors, $4,600 for CT scans and $15,926 to the OHSU Medical Group. Six liens totaling over $240,000 have been filed against me by the Salem Hospital and OHSU. I brought a copy of one of the bills with me, so you guys can kind of see for yourself what these bills look like. And something that really grabs my attention is $42,519.25 in supplies. That just doesn't make any sense to me.
Will we be able to have a copy? Is that what was given to us?
Not manager, that should know there's a packet that we didn't want to make available to everyone in the room because of personal reasons, but those packets are over there.
Because I would like to have that before not right now, but to make sure I have it before I meet with certain people.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Okay,
Senator Marissa.
I'm sorry, the amount was $42,000 for supplies?
Yes, sir.
And that is at OHSU or all together?
OHSU.
Okay.
OHSU did offer to reduce my bill for their hospital services from $111,000 down to $2,000 if we could find a way to pay off $2,000 immediately. They also offered us a chance to make $50 a month payments. That may seem reasonable, and I think it is reasonable. But Melody and I are unsure even where those payments would come from at this time. The bill just received yesterday shows they expect $50 a month payments, and they didn't drop the bill at all. In addition to my past medical bills, I face a life of future medical need. I have been told by my surgeon that I need another surgery. I continue to need more lab tests. My doctor has told me he needs a minimum of $60 per visit, or he cannot see me. When I was hospitalized at OHSU, I contracted a staph infection. The antibiotic cost alone is $200 a month. I tried to get on the NeedyMeds.com program, but my doctor referred me to a patient advocate who found that the special medications I need are no longer available through the drug companies. Our options are limited. Our credit cards are maxed out, and we wanted to file a homestead exemption, but cannot without an attorney. The crisis manager at Polk County Mental Health suggested that we sell our home and move into an apartment. But without credit or deposit money, how are we going to find a place to rent? Our house was on the market a year before we bought it, so selling it quick is really not a viable option. Bankruptcy is our last resort. There is more to our story. I am not the only one in my family with medical needs. Melody lady may have breast cancer and is getting help through the breast and cervical cancer program. She had been told by the breast cancer program doctor to be tested for Hodgkin's disease and needs a biopsy for a possible cancer in her arm. The tests she needs on her arm are not covered by the BCC program. Tests for the lymph nodes would be covered by the doctor. Covered, but the doctor doesn't feel they are necessary. So we are left wondering whether or not cancer is growing and what is going on. Medical costs aside, the injury and health challenges my family faces have left us emotionally drained and in need of mental health services that do not exist in Polk County unless you can pay something up front. I've dealt with a lot in my life, and I wish this experience on no one. Death should not result from uninsurance in this rich nation of ours. But in our case, I feel that we are looking at it on a daily basis, you know. That's all I've got to say.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. It takes, we can talk about this, we hear about the statistics, but it takes on a whole new meaning when someone who's actually experienced can tell their story. Any discussion? Thank you.
My name is Heather Sorensen. I live in Portland with my 14-year-old daughter, Skye. I was engaged to marry Casey Gleason, a man who had been a great father to my daughter and who brought happiness and stability into our lives. Until October, Casey was a successful mortgage broker. In the past 4 years, his business had started to boom. He was good at what he did. In 2003, he earned $250,000 a year. Casey received a notice that... Casey received a notice that he was uninsured on October 7th, 5 days after he suffered a head injury that rendered him incapable of even understanding what that meant. The head injury has drastically changed his life and the lives of us who love him. It's ironic that as Casey lay in a coma, first in Coos Bay Hospital, then Emmanuel, and finally Good Sam, the premium payment to support his coverage was being processed by Blue Cross Blue Shield, which subsequently returned the payment as and denied his continued enrollment. Myself, Casey's family, and Casey are left struggling to figure out how to pay over $400,000 in medical bills. We are grateful that modern medicine has saved Casey's life. Doctors perform miracles. We can afford to follow-up therapy as necessary. We have assured that Casey will be on track to become fully functional in 1 year. The bill attached to this testimony is a partial listing of what it has cost us to get to this point. I would like to refer to the first physician's lien. We also have, which it's sent certified mail, 12-7. And also the hospital ICU trauma recovery is $245,448.09, among other bills, and a surgery that was just performed today and more recovery to go. The bills keep coming in. Progressive rehabilitation is the treatment, which is the most promising, getting Casey fully functional. It will cost $40,000 a month. Doctors say he will be ready to start in June. That does not include his medication running about $300 to $400 a month. An additional doctors he needs to see. Right now, Casey goes to Emmanuel 3 days a week where he is working through cognitive, speech, occupational, and physical therapy. Those services are costing us $6,000 a month. Casey has a home valued at $211,000. He has investments valued at roughly $200,000. Emmanuel has filed a lien against his home and future income. If Casey were here right now, you would think he was a normal man, but he's not. They call people with traumatic brain injuries the walking wounded. Since Casey's accident, I have learned all I can about TBI. A traumatic brain injury happens every 21 seconds in this country. The number of reason is car accident. Number one reason is car accidents. The number two reason is slipping and falling. Casey gets confused, he's easily agitated and loses control of his emotions and impulses. He is depressed and sometimes suicidal. He doesn't know that his house and his assets are disappearing, but they will. We have enrolled Casey in OMIP. It's costing us roughly $230 a month. It will cover nothing related to his injury for 6 months. Medications, therapy, doctor visits, we pay insurance, but it covers nothing Casey most urgently needs. We continue to challenge Blue Cross Blue Shield's denial of coverage, but it seems like an uphill battle. This hearing is on health care costs, and I hope that Casey's story has let you see what they look like. I don't know how anyone gets through something like this financially and emotionally. Thank you.
Thank you. I see hands waving in the back. Thank you so very much for sharing your stories. Any questions? Sort of hard to ask questions. I mean, it affects us emotionally, so thank you. Would Linda Ingram please come up? Okay. Representative Dalto has to leave, but wants to thank all of you for being here.
Please introduce yourself. Okay, Chair Manas Anderson, and members of the committee. My name is Linda Ingham, and this is my husband Ken and our son Kenny. My husband and I are both state employees. In fact, I've been with the state for about 15 years. My husband's been with the state for over 10 years. And I'm one of the Oregonians. I'm a billboard on 12th and Union. Excuse me, I'm going to move my clothes up. Anyway, if you've seen the billboard on 12th and Union, and the billboard features Oregonians sharing their healthcare stories to put a human face on the healthcare crisis. We hope hearing the impact of high healthcare costs on our families and communities will spur the legislature to enact common sense solutions to reduce the cost of healthcare. There are many Oregonians who could have been featured because we're all paying the price for the skyrocketing of healthcare. Kenny, who is 8 years old, when he was 9 months old, was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis. If you're not familiar with that, it's a chronic illness. Anyway, to manage his illness, he must take enzymes with every meal. Right now, at his size, he takes 4 enzymes with every meal. As he gets older, he'll need to take more enzymes per meal, you know, as he gets older and grows bigger and stuff. Right now, if we didn't have prescription, if we didn't have coverage, the prescription drug coverage, the enzymes would be costing us $600 a month. And that's now. I mean, like I say, as he gets older, he'll be taking more. He also does an inhalant antibiotic every other month, which it's Toby, if you're familiar with that. That would be $2,500 a month. And so our situation is not unique. Many families struggle with caring for children who have chronic illnesses. We're fortunate to have affordable health care coverage through our employer. Yet, like most of working families in Oregon, we're paying more for health care. We have seen our out-of-pocket costs double in recent years, and our health care coverage has declined. 2 years ago, we accepted a pay freeze in order to protect our health care. So Ken and I are concerned about the future. As Kenny grows, he will need more prescriptions. And if prescription drugs costs increasing rapidly, will we be able to afford the prescriptions that Kenny's going to need in the future? So cutting health care benefits or shifting more costs to the employees does not reduce the problem. The real way to save the budget, to solve the budget shortfall and the health care crisis, is to crack down on the hospitals, the insurance companies, and the pharmaceutical companies who repeatedly overcharge the state and waste tax dollars. Oregon must work to reduce the cost of prescription drugs. The state needs to negotiate lower prices with drug companies and expand the state's purchasing pool to depress the price of pharmaceutical products. We need our legislators to stand up to the pharmaceutical insurance, and hospital companies to enact common sense solutions to get our health care costs under control, because right now we're all paying the price. And for us, it's real personal because this is our son's life, and most CF people are lucky to make it to 32 years old. About half of them do so. And then I don't even want to think about when he can't be covered on our health insurance, the time he's in his 20s. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to say one thing, too.
Please introduce yourself.
I'm Deb. If we no longer work for the state, Kenny becomes a burden to the state, because then we're going to have to find out how we can come up, as you've heard other stories, with money. This is an incurable, at this present time, disease that he has. So this is for his life. So the amount of money that's coming up is going to be continuing, and it's going to get worse. So we really need you to seriously do something about this problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Yes, Senator Morrison?
Do any of the drug companies have assistance program with that particular enzyme that you're talking about, or are you getting any help from the maker of the particular pharmaceutical?
His particular brand is L-Trace, and some of his stuff, we actually are connected with the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation also. But right now we have insurance, so it's covered as far as his enzymes. Yeah, and but there's different things. Like, he also takes a special vitamin, actually, and different things.
Yeah. Okay, you do have, of course, you have the insurance, and so therefore you are not eligible, so to speak, for special assistance from the Medicare Needy program. You're not eligible because you are covered right now.
Correct.
But if you are not covered, if there is a program that deals with that particular medication, you might be. But that's always a question. You can't always find the right pharmaceutical to deal with the need that you have from the pharmaceutical company. But thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you very much.
That's why the CF Pharmacy was started, because a lot of people couldn't get help for the medications that they need.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, the CF Pharmacy has just implemented something new. His vitamins were costing us $21.95, and they just enacted this month a $25 minimum order. So even though they're trying to hold the prices down for people, they're feeling the pinch also.
Yeah, and that's actually a vitamin, A, D, E, and K. So.
Can he introduce himself and tell us how old he is and where he goes to school?
Hello, my name is Kenny, and Washington Elementary is where my school is. My eight.
What grade are you in?
Second
grade. Do you like school?
Yeah, pretty much.
Thank you for coming and sharing your story.
Thank you.
Okay. David Bolton?
Good evening. Thank you, Chair Anderson and esteemed members of the committee. It's my pleasure to be here today to talk about something that's near and dear to my heart, and that is health insurance. I spent my whole entire
career... We need to introduce you.
Yes, sir. I'm Dave Bolton, and I've worked my entire career in insurance. I hold the designations from Health Insurance of America, of the HIA, MHP, RHU, and I've served on the board of CLU and Life and Health Underwriters in various
positions. I'm afraid we don't know all of what they mean.
I don't really want to waste the chair's time on all the designations, but what I did want to say is that I reviewed the 500 bills, and I'd like to commend the committee and congratulate you. I think they're fair and they're minded, and they will take care of part of the problem that we've heard about tonight with the health insurance crisis. I think one of the other things that I briefly wanted to state also is that I think the work of the union and the testimony of Leslie Frank is right on and needs to be considered. One of the things that we're all in the same boat on this, my neighbor, who is probably the most conservative person I know, we all agree that the health insurance costs are really driving down the Oregon economy. And until we get some sort of rein in on it, the cost to the employers, you can't add more people or increase wages as long as your insurance costs, commercial and health, are eating up pretty much all of the corporate profits that are going on. The other thing that I wanted to say briefly is the solution, I think, is you'll hear from varying people that the fair market will take care of things. And we tried that with the deregulation of health insurance called managed care and HMOs. And that hasn't worked out very well. So for the people that would say to you, just leave things alone, the market will take care of things, I think after all these years we've pretty much seen that the market won't take care of things and that we need legislation in order to bring things back into line. And I appreciate your time this evening. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any discussion? Thank you so very much. Lupita Salazar Lefcher? Was I close?
Close.
For the record, introduce yourself correctly.
My full name is Maria Guadalupe Castaña Salazar Lecher. I go by Lupita. Salazar Lecher is my last name. And I reside in Tigard. Thank you, Chairman Ms. Anderson and committee members for inviting us to provide testimony tonight. I'm here as part of the safety net, as part of the safety net that sees these very human faces that come into care. Come in asking for primary care, and that is what we do. That I'd like to tell you a little bit about my role with Yakima Valley Farm Workers Clinic is increasing access to health care as a nurse. This is something that I'm very proud of. What I'm hearing today is very heartbreaking, and I see in the clinic where I have my office people coming in, and it is very hard to see. Rosewood Family Health Center is in Multnomah County. We also have some safety clinics in Salem, Lancaster, and Salute, and actually some of our representatives have been out to visit these sites. And the mission of our organization, as well as other, I think I can speak very safely for the other safety nets, is to improve the quality of life for our clients. By providing cost-efficient, collaborative, culturally congruent health care. Probably about 30%, 35 to 40% of the population that we see are self-pay, meaning they are uninsured. The rest of that are on the Oregon Health Plan. They are in managed care. And a very 1-2% private insurance. The demographic population that we see is all inclusive. Latino, Asian, Russian populations, especially in Multnomah County. We also provide linguistic access, which is very important to our populations. They experience many, many barriers to care. And one of the reasons I'm here today is to illustrate how the high cost of health care and uninsurance affects our populations, our vulnerable populations, which today are being pitted against one another, the elderly, pregnant women, children. It's very hard to see. The conditions that we see in our clinics include chronically ill patients, primarily diabetes and hypertension, multi-system
illnesses, many medications, very complicated. And many of these people have been using the emergency room as a primary source of health care. Fortunately for us, some hospitals do recognize the role that we play as a safety net in keeping patients out of their emergency rooms. Pain management and drug addictions are other areas in other populations that we see. And what we are seeing with the environment changing as it has and the economic pressures are people forgoing preventive health care, continuous, and that is the basis of community health centers, to provide continuous, regular, efficient access to health care. That is very hard to do today. People are coming to us later. They can't afford to come. They're coming to us sicker. And we are managing them as best we can in the clinic setting. I'd like to give you some examples. We've had several diabetic patients come with blood sugars in the 600s. These are cases that hospitals manage. These patients don't want to go to the hospital for some of the very reasons we've heard tonight. So we have been able to manage some in our clinic and have them there and monitor them over the afternoon and have them come back the next day. Another example I can give you is a little more concrete, and I can actually give you some dollars that and give you an example of what, specifically, lack of prenatal care, what can happen. And this particular case is out of one of our clinics in Woodburn. We had a mother come at 24 weeks presenting in labor that had no prenatal care. She had twins, needed to be lifelighted out from Silverton to OHSU. And that the cost of this lack of prenatal care, lack of access, uninsured person, was $322,710.07. In contrast, we had another patient that came, accessed prenatal care regularly. She was a diabetic, and she was expecting triplets. The cost of this, including case management, was $21,000. Lastly, I would like to speak to what safety nets do in providing access to health care regardless of insurance, regardless of ability to pay. We have sliding scales according to income. We do not turn people away. But to illustrate another example of what our safety net is experiencing is, as we opened our doors in Monroe County, just down the road from us was a closure of Multnomah County Health Department Clinic Southeast. 8,000 people without health care in their community. Within a short period of time, just as we opened down the road, we saw 4,000 people, which is very difficult to do with a staff of 3 providers and the amount of time that it takes when you just see new patients. But I thank you for your time. And again, as part of the safety net, I think we see our communities, we provide them the care regardless. Again, the sustainability issue is huge for us. And there is a cost shift to the safety net. And if I can be available of any resource, I would love to do what I can for you. Yes, Senator Marcet.
Thank you. Do you have any, maybe you're not the right person to ask about this in your team, but the repayment from the state of Oregon, the wraparound repayment when you submit a claim for services rendered to Oregon Health Fund, whatever, do you have any idea how long it takes to get that?
Chairman Sanderson and Senator Morrison, we are a federally qualified health center.
Yes.
We do receive PPS payments,
yes,
for our clinics, and I do know that it takes a very long time, up to a year. I can also share that this is especially difficult for new clinics,
mm-hmm,
and Oregon has been very fortunate to be to benefit from the president's initiative to increase the number of community health centers.
Mm-hmm.
However, when the clinic is just opening, to have to wait for those payments is very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. Again, speaking to the sustainability issue.
We have a federally qualified health clinic, in Springfield. I visited there. I got that information. I do have a bill that I'm hoping won't be necessary, because I'm hoping that Department of Human Services will speed up their efficiency. But we have a bill that would require a 30-day turnaround time.
That would be wonderful.
Right. I'm hoping that it can be done without the bill, but that's a big issue, because when you have that much money, that doesn't come back.
That's
right. One other thing, could you tell us how many people are in your, how many providers, what's the breakdown? You have a doctor, you have a nurse, and who else do you have in your clinic?
In our clinic, in one clinic in particular, I can give you an example of, at present, four providers, one of which is a family nurse practitioner,
okay,
and we will be hiring two more,
okay,
doctors, all of which are family practice doctors, and all of our deliveries, they do and have privileges at Adventist Hospital.
Okay. One other quick question, if,
yes,
I may. Do you provide some dental maintenance work in your clinic?
Unfortunately, at this time, we do not.
Okay.
However, in Multnomah County,
uh-huh,
however, in Woodburn, at our,
uh-huh,
Salud Clinic, we do. In fact, we're just undergoing a major expansion and adding dental chairs.
Oh,
dental,
good,
is a huge need in our communities, and at present, it's difficult to just do sealants and extractions.
Now, one other quick question. You don't turn anybody away, right?
No, sir.
Thank you.
I want to thank you for working in the safety net clinic.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful profession working in the healthcare field, but it takes a very special person to work with in the safety net clinics, because the cases are sometimes so sad, so frustrating, because of the high costs of medical care, lack of insurance, etc. So thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Mary Lou Henrik.
Yeah.
Yes, hello. I didn't see you in the back.
Yeah.
Good evening, Senator Martha Sanderson and committee. My name is Mary Lou Henrich for the record, and I really didn't plan to testify tonight, so I don't have written testimony, but several people, when I came in the room, said, are you going to testify? And I said, well, I hadn't planned on it, but they convinced me that maybe I had something that might be helpful to say. And not shy, right? That's it. No, as Senator Martha Sanderson knows, I've worked for more than 30 years in public health for Multnomah County, and then at CURE Oregon, and now I'm with a nonprofit called Community Health Partnership. And I'm really not going to, as I listened and thought about what am I going to say tonight, I'm not going to talk about my professional experience, the home visits I made, the clinics I worked in, the getting prenatal care, the starting school-based health centers, a whole variety of things, and Senator Anderson also helped in many of those things.
What I'm going to do is tell you two quick stories, one about a very good friend who was a nurse who, very much like the first gentleman who spoke, had her life changed by an automobile accident. She now has lost her nursing license because she kept trying to work as a single mother, keeping body and soul together. And in the pain that she had after three cervical surgeries with rods and screws and spokes put in her back, and the medications that she was prescribed to take because of the pain and trying to keep working, she really wasn't able to do her job towards the end. And she ended up losing her job and losing her license, which is at 57 years old, a very sad thing. So her mental health and her physical health are terrible. We cheered about a year and a half ago when she was able to get Social Security disability, because before that she had been on unemployment and then only existed because her sister died and left her a small inheritance that kept her in this period where she's trying to get some income for she and her son. And she gets now what is considered to be 150% or more of the federal poverty level. She gets $1,219 a month. And so I just quickly added up her expenses, her $600 for rent, $117 for electricity, that's both the lights and the heat, $30 for phone, $108 for car insurance, because she is desperately trying to hang on to her car so that she can get to medical appointments and get places without me and all of her other friends, of which there aren't a whole bunch anymore, because she, as she says, I wear people out. And honestly, it does wear people out, and I've just hung in there with her because she has no family. Nobody except her son, who's now the only bright spot, is he got a college scholarship to a prestigious college on the East Coast and left this year when she was 3 days post-surgery. We put him on an airplane by himself to New York, and he just finished his first semester and got 4 A's and 1 C+, and the C+ was in calculus. So anyway, he's hanging in there, she's hanging in there, but it is so difficult. And so we've got her on some of the prescription drug benefits, where you go through all of the application, etc. And in December, an example happened where it was time to reapply. The doctor she's going to, somehow his office did not get the paperwork submitted that needed to be submitted. So the drug company said, when she called, geez, we don't have the paperwork. We had taken it. I had taken it to the doctor's office for her. They finally resurrected it, got it sent in, thought everything was going to be okay. She was like down to 3 days worth of medication. We thought, okay, it's going to work. And she called to check, and they said, no, the doctor had forgotten to put the prescription in this time. So now we didn't have prescription. So we called, got the prescription, got it sent. But I actually explained, and what the doctor's office said was, well, we'll write you a prescription so she can go to the pharmacy and buy it herself. 7 days' worth was $169. This was a week before Christmas. She had managed to save $82 to be able to have some money to buy her son something for Christmas and to have Christmas dinner. Well, I wasn't going to let her spend her $82 on that. So I helped her out, bought the prescription. But it's like living on the edge. And I think until I really walked next with her in these years through this, I don't think I got it. I've been lucky. I have had insurance for my family. And have not looked. She has got, the good thing is she owns no house. So when she gets all of the bills that come, she has Medicare now. But when she didn't, and even though she has it now, there's always co-pays and extra money. And these bills come, and they come from the collection agencies. And what I do is I rip them up. I say, you know, Marie, they can't get blood out of this turnip. There is no way. You have nothing. You have a dilapidated car. I guess if they want that, they can come and get it. But other than that, she doesn't have anything. We need to pay off the car so that she could get out of the high interest rate she had. We sold her sister's engagement ring in December, the one thing her sister had left her, and we managed to get $1,000 and pay off the car. So having kind of done this, I've really experienced, even though in my life I've been lucky, in my life I've worked in clinics, seen people coming and going, and been involved, but not quite at this level. And the second story is even closer to home, and I hope I can kind of hang together while I tell you this, because this has to do with my son. My son is 25 years old. He is a wonderful young man who, at age 20, was diagnosed with bipolar. And he has had Kaiser insurance coverage all of his life through us, but at his age, we're in the last 1 month, this month, of being able to cover him on COBRA. He will not be covered as of April 1st. So then we've been checking into, can we get him covered through Kaiser individual insurance? And no, he'll be underwritten out because he has a chronic disease. Even though he's been going there since he was 5 years old, getting all of his care there, we will not be able, because he's not part of a group health insurance plan, and he has been unable to sustain employment with his disease. So he's currently living in our basement and trying to get his medications balanced and his life on track. He's a very intelligent young man. He gets very, very depressed about the situation his life is in and kind of where is he going to go from here. And a couple of years ago when he had been diagnosed and I had the choice to put him on COBRA, he could have applied for the Oregon Health Plan. At the time, I was the director of Care Oregon. And I just thought, there are many more people in this state who need the Oregon Health Plan than my son, even though he was zero income at that point. So I said, no, we will just pay that COBRA. So we've been paying $385 a month for the last 3 years to cover him on COBRA. But it's no longer going to be an option next month. So we will probably be going through OMIP, trying to figure, all these pieces out, but then there'll be the 6 months where a pre-existing condition isn't covered. So his medications are several hundred dollars a month if it wasn't being covered right now under his Kaiser insurance. So even people who, I have been in this business all of our lives, have dedicated our lives to helping, to trying to figure it out. We're oftentimes sitting here, too, saying, I don't look that much different than anybody else in this room, and yet it's affecting me and my family. And I take my hats off to you for at least trying on this Senegal 500 series because they certainly won't answer all the problems, but we've got to take a step. We have got to do something to rein in the exorbitant costs that you heard about here. With Kaiser, we've been lucky in terms of you don't really see how much things are costing, but with my friend Marie, I have seen her bills, and this last surgery where she fell in August, the surgeon's bill was over $10,000, and anesthesia was about $5,000, and then the supplies, and this was not at OHSU, were $6,000. So the costs have got to come under control, and we've all got to work together, and I commend you for your action on this.
Thank you. Thank you, Mary Lou. Any comments?
Well,
Senator Marcet.
What's the prognosis for your son for stabilization and having a job and so on? Is it a medication issue or is it more?
Well, bipolar, we had an experience about 2 years ago where he ended up in the emergency room. And we were talking, our son is great about saying, hey, we can talk in front of my parents because there's all this, regulations on confidentiality, et cetera. So he said, bring my parents in, let's talk. And we did. And the psychiatrist who was there that day said, I've been in practice of psychiatry for 35 years, about my age. And he said, what I can say, the good news is that we're light years ahead of treating this kind of disorder than we were 35 years ago. He said, I cringe when I think about things that we did to people. But he said, he believes that in 10 years, he said, the goal Mary Lou and Brent and Ken, is to keep Brent alive for 10 more years.
To what?
To keep him alive so that he doesn't get so depressed that he decides that about 40% of people with bipolar commit suicide.
Now, would mental health parity if we had that?
Well, with Kaiser, his insurance actually probably it is about as parityed as it can be. So we have...
Yeah.
He's able to see a psychiatrist for medication management, and the medicines are considered like any others. But it still is, their psychiatrists are, he can have a half an hour visit every 3 months with the psychiatrist to do medication management. And basically what they do is look at the side effects of the medicine and how to balance it. He really can't have, you know, an hour a month to really talk about issues with the psychiatrist because that's not covered. So I think a mental health parity that allowed, you know, other than just managing medication would be good and important. But I don't know. It's what I said to Brent is, Brent was, when he's really down, he'll say, Mom, I encouraged him to read up and to learn all about the disease. And on one hand, you kind of think that's an important thing, but on the other hand, one day when I came home and he was kind of slumped in the chair, he said, well, I did what you told me to. He said, I went on the internet and I read all about it. And he says, do you want the statistics? Do you want to know that 80% of people with bipolar can't hold a job, Mom? I said, 20% do. He said, you know, 40% kill themselves. I said, 60% don't. And I said, the thing that you've got going for you here is you have a family that is supportive, that is going to be there with you, and no matter what it takes, we're going to be there helping you get what you need. How many people don't have that? So I don't know. I hope and pray that my son will be able to realize his full potential, and that the psychiatrist who told us that he believes in 10 years that the medications that they need to really target specifically what he needs will be there. And in the meantime, we just kind of go day to day.
You're very brave. Thank you.
Thanks. My son's the brave one.
Thank you, Mary Lou, for bearing that.
I'll call George Stream and Rosalie Pedrosa. You come up to them. Rosalie, do you want to start?
Hi, I'm Rosalie Pedrosa from Turner, and I also didn't plan on testifying today, but then decided to do that. And you can go out every day and feed your sheep for a year and nothing happens, and then one day you go out to feed them and one of them bumps you, and the next thing you know you're in the hospital for 5 days. And to date I've been 5 months in recovery and still recovering. As you've noticed, I'm not walking all that great yet. Even with months of physical therapy, it takes a long time to recover. My costs so far have been between $40,000 and $50,000 for physical therapy, hospital bill, doctor's bills, and all that. Fortunately, I do have health insurance. You probably noticed I'm wearing an SEIU t-shirt. And I do have health insurance coverage. With my co-pays, I'll pay a fraction of what I would have had to pay out of pocket if I had no insurance. But even at that, I'm struggling to make those payments. And as you've heard tonight, we're all one catastrophic accident or healthcare crisis away from losing everything we own if we don't have insurance coverage, or if our co-pays are so large and our deductibles. And I know I'm fortunate, but I also know I took a 2-year pay freeze to keep my health insurance. And each year, as others have said tonight already, it becomes more and more likely that I will have to choose between health care and pay cuts, or pay raises and health care cuts. And the health care crisis continues to go on, and it continues to grow. And as far as health care accounts, as was mentioned earlier by the gentleman from AOI, or representing AOI, you have to earn enough to be able to set money aside for an account in the first place. And I think you've heard story after story tonight that people don't have the money to set aside for accounts. So I hope that isn't any on your plate at all to consider. And the people that have the money to set aside don't need health insurance in the first place because they can just pay for their health care. And so I just wanted to thank you all tonight for everything you've been doing on behalf of trying to get a handle on the health care costs. And I encourage you to continue to support the 500 series bills for passage. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Any discussion? Any questions?
Good evening, Chairman Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is George Stein and I live in Albany. And I wanted to share with you the difficulties of paying for health care in today's world. After hearing some of the stories, as bad as I feel our situation is to life for myself, it pales by comparison on the things that I've heard. But anyway, excuse me, I am 68 years old, my wife is 73, we've been married 47 years. The wife has been a 7-year survivor of cancer, but was recently diagnosed with the early stages of Alzheimer's. She requires a great deal of medication on an ongoing basis. Through 2014 of 05, I've already laid out of my pocket, our pocket, nearly $500 for prescriptions with coverage that I just recently got the first of the year. I imagine what the retail value might be. Until I retired at the end of 2003, I worked for a management company at OHSU. I was there 9.5 years. I worked 2 jobs and made pretty good money. My wife was diagnosed with this cancer in September of 97, I believe it was. Over the course of 18 months, treatments and testing and all the things that had to be paid out. I had coverage at that time. When it was all said and done and the operation was finally completed and the treatment was given, the insurance paid it probably in excess of $36,000, leaving me with another $11,000 or $12,000. Now, whether or not it was because I was employed on the campus of OHSU, they were pretty accommodating. And over the years since that time, I had been allowed to pay interest-free at the rate of $25 a month, which has been quite beneficial. I thought at the end of 2003 that I had a plan that I was going to be able to survive in retirement, and it was probably not more than a month or so went by, and I found that wasn't going to work. We had a home built in 1999. We had it 5 years. It was it paid in part with an inheritance from a brother that passed away. We have since lost that house. We are now living in a motorhome, which was purchased before all of these things started to transpire, in the hope that we would be able to travel. Does not seem to be possible at this time. I went back to work in March of 2004. At Albany General Hospital, I work as a housekeeper. My basic wage is $9.01 an hour. And because of my health, I could not work full-time. After about 9 months there as a casual on-call, a position opened up, and my probationary period was over. And an opportunity presented itself to work 30 hours a week with benefits, effective January of this year. So that has been quite beneficial. However, there are ongoing health issues, not only with my wife, but with myself. I'm up for a knee replacement surgery, possibly starting December 28th. However, I find that in the pre-testing process for the surgery, they have discovered that there may be a potentially serious health issue with my heart. Testing is ongoing. I do not know exactly where this is going to lead and what effect it's going to have on my knee replacement surgery. In regards to that surgery, the doctor's fee alone will be $5,000 for each knee. I know that the hospital stay will usually be about 3 days, and the cost to me with coverage is $100 per day, which is out of pocket. I am not sure where or what the other cost will be. Nevertheless, I've been told that I will have to pay whatever I owe within 90 days. If I can't, I will not be given time to pay without interest, as I was given the opportunity at OHSU. Instead, my bills will be sent to a collection agency. I am very concerned about this, but without having these surgeries, I will not be able to continue work for long, and I must work in order to pay my wife's medications. I know that many employees pay much more out-of-pocket for health insurance than I do. I know that many people have higher hospital bills. Still, I thought it might be helpful for you to hear about the gaps in the coverage for ordinary older Oregonians. I believe that what we get charged for health care should be based on our ability to pay. I also believe that the state and federal government should take the actions that you folks are working on now to make health care more affordable, and I encourage you to do it, even if it means taking on the very powerful forces in the health care business. Thank you.
A lot of hands waving. Thank you very, very much. The last two people that we have signed up are Marie, is it Arthur, and Carly Jackson, if you both want to come in.
Hi, my name is Carly Jackson, and I am a state of Oregon employee. I work for the Oregon Health Plan, and I was asked to testify about 15 minutes ago, so I do not have any written testimony, but I do appreciate the opportunity to tell my story here. I'm a single mother of two teenage children, and one of the reasons why I started working for the state of Oregon wasn't necessarily the money. It really had to do with the benefits that we would get. Both my daughter and I have chronic health problems. We both have attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder. And we both
say that again.
Attention deficit okay. and hyperactivity disorder. Mm-hmm. We both have asthma. And unfortunately, as much as I hate to say this, we both have ulcers. Right at this point in time, I'm paying between $70 and $80 a month in just in prescription costs for co-payments. Because, of course, I am covered by health insurance. I went to a new patient examination. It was a short visit with a new physician, about 10 minutes. My co-payment, my co-insurance on that was $15. I, several years ago, had to have a hysterectomy because of precancerous lesions on my cervix, and I have to have two pap smears a year, only one of which is covered. The other one I have to pay for. And my son, just a year ago, sliced his hand open in three places and required stitches in the emergency room. The bill that I received from Salem Emergency Physicians and Salem Emergency Room was almost $200 just to get him stitched up. That's with health insurance. And then just at the near the end of last year, I found a lump on my breast. By the time I had finished all the testing and had that lump removed, I had almost $500 in doctor bills. It was rare for me to open up my mailbox and not find several bills in there. Being a single mother, I have very little disposable income. All of it goes towards our necessities. Keeping my children fed has to be the priority. And it got to the point where there were so many doctor's bills, I could not afford to pay anything. I lost a doctor because I could not afford to pay my co-insurance. They wanted $95 a visit for the next three visits. When I owed them, that particular doctor, just $24. In November of last year, I had to declare bankruptcy because of those constant medical costs. Now, it's a surprise to open up my mailbox because it's rare to find anything but junk mail in there and our regular living expenses. And at this point, a bit of a relief. But unfortunately, because of these chronic conditions, it's necessary to visit doctors regularly to keep them under control so that I can continue working and my daughter can continue getting her education. And those bills are beginning to appear again. It's hard enough to pay these constant bills without the uncertainty about premium costs. One thing I will be unable to do is just take even more money out of my paycheck every month to be able to continue our health insurance by paying part of the premiums. We need to find a way to control these costs. Someone with health insurance should not be paying almost $200 to a hospital in order to get stitches on her son's hand. We should be able to receive the preventative care that we need. I am required to get those two pap smears in order to make sure that the cancer does not come back. But unfortunately, I still have to scrape together the money to pay for that second one. It is about prevention, because if the cancer does come back and it's not caught early enough, I will be forced to go through chemotherapy, more surgeries, which will just end up costing the healthcare industry more when I'm unable to pay those bills. We've heard a lot of stories tonight that were very affecting. Thousands and thousands of dollars being owed. People having to declare bankruptcy, and mine may seem small, but unfortunately, it's also not unusual. I'm here to tell my story, but I've heard the same one from many of the people that I work with. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Marie Arthur, and I live in Salem. And after listening to these people tonight, my concerns seem rather insignificant, but I will tell them anyway. This is regarding my health insurance. My insurance went from a copay of $10 in 2003 to $15 in 2004, now it's $20. Since 2003, that's doubled. Hospitalization went from $40 a day for the first 5 days in 2004 to $100 a day for 8 days this year. That's $200 compared to $800. However, my monthly premium went down $5. Wow. I called my insurance company about this, you know, because of this high jump in the hospitalization, and I was told that Medicare set the rate. And I thought, wow, this is really amazing, because my husband's insurance hasn't gone up for several years. Several years ago, it was $7 copay. It went up to $10, and it stayed there. So
if I could keep my own doctor, I would change to my husband's insurance, but I couldn't keep him. He's not on their plan. So tomorrow I'm going to West Salem to check out Providence plan. I think this is really terrible for seniors or people on low income budgets. It's just, what do we do if we don't have the money, or we can't expect a raise that keeps up with these increases in premiums? So that's what I came to talk about. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And you're not the first senior to bring this to my attention. There have been several from the Gresham area that have come to me sharing the very same story, that they've had insurance for many, many years, and now all of a sudden the premiums or the services costs have skyrocketed, and they're very concerned.
So I just found it so interesting that I was told that the Medicare set this premium, and yet my husband's didn't skyrocket like that. It's been that same price for years, and it's just like, so.
Well, we have some transparency bills in the work too, so we'll see. we'll see if we can figure out why some people are treated differently than others.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Well, that is all that we have. Is Mark Holliday or Gail McDougall here? I know that they weren't signed up, but we had information that you weren't. No, they're not here. Okay. Well, I want to thank everyone for coming, and it makes such a difference to hear the personal stories. Truly, it really has a much greater impact than these people from the agencies coming and giving us facts and figures. Is there any comments from the committee? Thank you so much, and I will adjourn.